like to call to order the October 24th, 2024 meeting of the City of Savannah Zoning Board of Appeals. This is a quasi-judicial proceeding. All those wishing to give testimony during these proceedings will please sign in. Witnesses will be sworn in prior to giving testimony. All proceedings of the Savannah ZBA are recorded. Decisions of the ZBA are final, and challenges to the Savannah Zoning Board of Appeals must be filed through the Superior Court of Chatham County. If you have any cell phones or noise-making devices, please turn them off at this time. And if you will, please stand with me and join me in the prayer and the Pledge of Allegiance. Father, we just thank you for this day to come together, do the business of this city. Thank you for your presence here. Lord, thank you for the privilege of living in such a great city. Father, I pray that you give us wisdom today, help us to make right decisions. And Lord, I just thank you in the name of Jesus. Amen. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. If you plan on speaking or giving testimony today, would you please stand? And I want to swear you in. If you're online, use the raise your hand feature. Repeat after me. I do solemnly swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help me God. Thank you. We have two items requested to be removed from the final agenda. 301 Forest Avenue, that's 24-005289, and 533, 535, and 537 East Gwinnett Lane, 24-005227. Is there a motion to remove these from the final agenda?
So moved.
All right. Mr. Turner has made a motion to remove these from final agenda. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Condon. Mr. Griffith, how do you vote?
Yes.
Mr. Turner?
Yes.
Mr. Condon?
Yes.
And Mr. Ball?
Yes.
All right. Motion passes and these will be removed. Next, we have the approval of the minutes from the October. This is the October. Okay. The October 2nd, 2024 meeting. I have a motion to approve those minutes.
Motion.
Motion by Mr. Condon. You have a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Turner. Mr. Griffith, how do you vote?
Yes.
Mr. Turner?
Yes.
Mr. Condon?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Ball?
Yes.
All right. Motion passes and the minutes are approved. Next, we need to approve the final agenda.
May I make a motion? A motion that we swap items 7 with 8.
All right.
The order.
And then approve the rest of it.
And approve the rest of the agenda.
All right. Mr. Turner has made a motion to swap items number 7 and 8 in the order that they're going to come in and approve the agenda. Otherwise, is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Condon. Mr. Griffith, how do you vote?
Yes.
Mr. Turner?
Yes.
Mr. Condon?
Yes.
Mr. Ball?
Yes.
All right. The motion passes and the agenda is approved. All right, we have an item on the consent agenda. That's 4790 Waters Avenue. It's a variance for a sign, 24-004597. Do I hear a motion to approve the consent agenda?
A motion that we approve.
All right, Mr. Turner has made a motion to approve the consent agenda. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Condon. Mr. Ball, how do you vote?
Yes.
Mr. Condon?
Yes.
Mr. Turner?
Yes.
And Mr. Griffith?
Yes.
All right. Thank you. All right. First, we're going to hear 2201 Fernwood Court. This is a variance for an accessory dwelling unit, 24-003627.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. My name is Brad Clement. I work on development services staff here at the Metropolitan Planning Commission. The case before us was before this board previously. It has been continued since July 25th of this year. The reason for the continuance was to give the petitioner the ability to meet with the neighborhood association as there were issues related to the case and the structure in question. The structure in question happens to be an additional dwelling unit that is a converted accessory structure that is original to the primary. The current owner was not there when the structure was converted. What's at question here is the use. You'll see that the request is relief from nonconformity or relief from the minimum lot area requirement of 125% to allow for an additional dwelling unit. So the structure original to the dwelling unit was a permitted and allowed an original structure accessory to the primary when the house was built. House was built sometime in the 70s. Fast forward to 2024, the petitioner is not that original owner. The conversion appears to have happened in 2013, but there is no evidence certain that it was either permitted or not. There was a zoning confirmation letter sought in 2013 to establish or to reconfigure for an ADU use. But prior to the adoption of the new zoning ordinance in 2019, that was unallowable, and the zoning confirmation letter indicates so. During that same time, several building permits. This is the subject property, by the way. This is a well-established older neighborhood. We have some members of the neighborhood, to include the neighborhood association president here today, I believe, is going to speak. The lot is conforming under the current zoning configuration, which is now RSF6. So it's 60 feet frontage, 6,000 square feet. That's where the 125% upsize of the lot would be required to establish an ADU, which was apparently, whenever it was converted and established, it wouldn't have met anyway because it was not an allowable use. But the 125% thing is a variance that this board is very much familiar with. You'll see on your screen the 2013 timeframe and building permits that were filed legally and associated with this property. Because an additional dwelling unit would not have been permitted at the time, there was no second address. So the address listed is the 2201 Fernwood Court address. But when you're talking about mechanical, electrical, and plumbing rough-ins, these are the type of permits that would be drawn to establish such a use. There is no trail in the record to determine whether that was part of a home renovation. Generally, as part of a renovation, you would not redo a rough-in unless the structure is being rebuilt. But again, there is no evidence for or against. This is simply where the facts are. And I don't mean to belabor the point, because this is otherwise a very simple variance ask for relief from the 125% lot coverage for an ADU, which is a by right allowable use under the current ordinance. But there is the piece of nonconformity, and how was it established and when was it established, and that is fact uncertain. I'm not going to go through all of the things in the variance checklist. There is no topographic hardship. Literal interpretation of the current ordinance would make this allowable and only put it in opposition to the 125% that I've described. This does not convey any special favor. The complicated part of this is the untangling of the conflicting nonconformity versus the current variance under when it was established, what's present now, when did the present owner or petitioner become involved in this case, and the concerns of the neighbors. You'll see the structure here. The only permits drawn by the current owner have been for renovation when he took ownership of the properties. I should mention also that the existing ADU is tenant occupied. There's a person living in it, or at least there was at the time that the petition was filed. It's a rental unit. Here are the dimensions. It is conforming in every way except for the 125%. If this were a simple variance case, but this is also entangled with the relief from nonconformity, as discussed. Staff's recommendation is approval of the relief from nonconformity, which under the current zoning ordinance would not be applicable, and the 125% lot size requirement for the establishment of an ADU under the current ordinance. The subject ADU, and again, this was referred by code compliance. That's how it got here. has been subsequently inspected by the building department. And so there is a certificate of occupancy. So these things are somewhat in conflict. I will stop my thoughts and speaking now, because there may be several other people here, but I'm here to answer any questions you have, but would otherwise be a very simple, straightforward case.
Thank you very much. Is there any questions for staff? All right, thank you. Would petitioner please come forward and state your name for the record?
Logan Ulm. I'm obviously here for this case. Just to kind of give you guys a brief background, I purchased the property in January. There was a tenant there at the time. I've owned it for a few years now. That's actually my brother-in-law that currently lives in the accessory unit. My sister-in-law lives in the main dwelling, and we intend to continue that. There's no end to that current living situation or what our intended use of the property is. Like he mentioned, whenever I purchased the home, it was already a rental, and to my knowledge had been for, I would guess, since it was built. I think that's why they converted it originally. So for basically 10 years, it sat there with those same purposes in the community. It wasn't until I started remodeling the main dwelling that this was brought to my attention that had never been zoned properly. And I know we have an issue with the lot size variance, as Brad mentions. That is a corner lot. And when the lot lines were laid by the city, a fair amount of my lot was taken in. So it's a corner lot. And if you measure just the curb to curb around the corner, we've got like 7,800 square feet. So if that makes any, you know, if that's any addition. So if you measured what the yard that I take care of, it's well within those. Even though it's not my actual property, I do have a photo of what this looks like from the street view. If you'd like to see it, I'm not sure if that's relevant or not. Just to show you that it is well off the street. It's hidden now behind a privacy fence. It shouldn't really, you know, it's no visual issue, I guess is what I'm getting at. So also, as Brad mentioned, we've basically, I think since, was it August? We I think was our first attempt to meet with the neighborhood to, it was brought to my attention there were some issues. The neighborhood didn't want to approve this. They were in conflict with it, with the approval. Since then, I've tried to meet. They hold meetings every 2 months, and for one, you know, storm or another, it's gotten canceled. So we've kind of had to drag it out to this point. I actually had to leave everything unoccupied up until we could get an approval. As he mentioned, the building inspector came by. I was able to meet with Miss Edna Jackson because she was one of the main voices that was in opposition. I met with her shortly after becoming aware that she had an issue with the approvals, and I was able to address many of the concerns that she had, and she gave me her stamp of approval. Obviously, I'm speaking on her behalf. She's not here today. I think that's pretty much all I have. I think I've hit all the key points. Do y'all have any questions for me?
Are there any questions for the petitioner? No, sir. Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Reuben Huckabee, are you here?
Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Excuse me. My name is Reuben Huckabee. I'm the president of the Fernwood Parkwood Community Association. I moved there in 1979, and as the petitioner stated, that house was basically where it was up to present. Fernwood Parkwood is a community of older people. From 79 to now, they've started dying out. We're seeing a demographic change. When you talk to older people, they are afraid because they get pounded 6 o'clock in the morning phone calls from people who are trying to purchase their homes, substandard prices. I had an offer the other day for two properties on a Friday, like, here's some money, take it. The people that elected me not want to lose their home. If you give one person the permission to be out of compliance, but you're in the neighborhood, you're opening it up for everyone else. Because once you say yes to one person, you can't change back and forth and back and forth. We're asking that if it is not legitimate, According to the city's ADU, we want it denied. Any questions?
Thank you, sir. Are there any other members of the public that want to speak? Anybody online? All right.
No, sir.
Would you like to refute public comment?
My only rebuttal is that I think Mr. Rubin stood on the point that if it isn't in compliance with the city's rules and regulations, but as we read that portion of the code, I'll let Brad back me up on this or correct me if I'm wrong. The very next sentence that addresses the nonconformity due to lot size, the very next sentence is, this is variable. So that's kind of where we're at on the issue.
Okay. But this time we'll enter into board discussion. Mr. Ball, do you have anything you'd like to say?
I just don't see taking away existing housing, which we'd probably approve now if it were applied for now. So I don't see a problem with it the way it is.
Mr. Condon?
I agree with Mr. Ball.
Mr. Turner?
No comment.
Mr. Griffith?
Just the fact that since this is already here, I don't think that this is going to set a precedent for the neighborhood. So I'm in favor of supporting the recommendation.
Okay. Would someone like to make a motion?
I make a motion we approve the variance request.
Okay, Mr. Ball has made a motion to approve the variance request, and that and includes the relief of nonconformity.
Yeah,
kind of a two-part thing.
Correct.
All right, so is there a second to the motion?
Second.
Second by Mr. Griffith. Any discussion on the motion? Mr. Griffith, how do you vote?
Yes.
Mr. Turner?
Yes.
Mr. Condon?
Yes.
Mr. Ball?
Yes.
All right, motion passes and variance is approved. Next, we're going to hear 417 West Bolton Street,
24-005223. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the board. This is Edward Morrow, Director of Development Services here at the MPC. So your second petition is 417 West Bolton Street. Mr. Fellman is the applicant requesting to convert what was originally a commercial space on a mixed-use parcel in the Victorian District into a dwelling unit. He's requesting a variance for off-street parking that's required in order to permit that that reduction because NUZO currently requires that there's one off-street parking space for each dwelling unit that's provided. So this is the adaptive reuse of an existing structure that was built in or about 1900, according to the tax assessor. And in essence, you have two structures that are on this parcel, a total of five residential units that are proposed. But on the current kind of principal structure that's on the building, you have a ground floor non-residential use, and then you have apartments that are up top. And then at the rear of the parcel, there is what would have been likely a carriage house that contains two dwelling units. And so ultimately, that non-residential space is the one that's in question. And so this is something that this board has dealt with actually last time, where we talked about the reuse of existing non-conforming structures and the parking allowances that are given them on the fact that they were constructed for other purposes. So this is a request, in essence, about that grandfathered parking. But what are we going to kind of give them credit for on the basis that this structure was built for something that might have actually been more intense? And so I'll just draw your attention to point number five here under findings, actually five and six. So the petitioner received a zoning confirmation letter confirming that one off-street space was going to be required for that non-residential to residential conversion. And then provision 9.3.4A4 of the ordinance provides credit for legal non-conforming parking areas. This was a non-residential use originally on the basis of this grandfathered parking provision. It is very likely that this space at its current size, which I should have in here, I believe it's about 700 square feet. Nonetheless, it is a space of a size that would have been afforded in excess of one off-street parking space given its size based on current provisions. And it's on that basis that MPC staff does recommend approval of this request. I would like to enter the report into the record, but I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions for staff? None. Thank you, Mr. Morrow. Would the petitioner please come forward?
Gentlemen, good morning. My name is Mark Feldman. I own this property. Just the background of this, I purchased this about 2 years ago. This has been a lot of lessons learned. It's been abandoned probably 10 years prior to me purchasing it. We applied for the permit well before anything was brought about parking, and the permit that was applied for was for 5 residential units. It was approved, and during the permitting process, you know, there was never a conversation about parking. So I operated on the assumption that we're good to go. And then after the permits are approved and things have been started, this was brought to my attention that, you know, I don't have the required parking. You know, hence I come before you to ask for the variance for the one parking. If you'd like, I took videos on different times of the day, on different days of the week, showing the street view. There is no other residential structures on that block. The only neighbor is a church, and they have a ownership of the whole city block with plenty of parking. That's to say that this variance will not have any negative effect on anybody else. And said, I'm happy to pull up the video with the timestamps to show the different times of days and days of the week. Any questions for me?
Thank you very much, sir. Any questions for the petitioner? Thank you.
Right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Any members of the public that wish to speak concerning this petition? Do we have any online?
No, sir.
All right. In that case, we'll enter into board discussion. Mr. Griffith, do you have anything you'd like to say?
No.
Mr. Turner?
No, sir.
Mr. Condon?
No, sir.
Mr. Bell?
No.
Okay, would someone care to make a motion?
I make a motion to accept staff's recommendation and grant relief.
All right. Mr. Griffith has made a motion to accept staff's recommendation and grant relief. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Turner. Any discussion on the motion? Mr. Ball, how do you vote?
Yes.
Mr. Condon?
Yes.
Mr. Turner?
Yes.
Mr. Griffith?
Yes.
All right. Motion passes and relief is granted. Next, we're going to hear 507 Staley Avenue, a variance for reduction of lot width and relief from lot size, 24-005293.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the board, Edward Morrow again. This is a request on behalf of CHSA, which is the City of Savannah's nonprofit affordable housing developer. The petitioner has acquired the property at 507 Staley Avenue, which is currently zoned RSF6. This is a single family zoning district that only permits detached single family residences. Ideally with a minimum, it requires 60 feet of frontage and 6,000 square feet of area. So ideally parcels that are 60 by 100. There is some additional space here. As you can see, this is the subject parcel on your screen. There is an existing dwelling that is on it that, it's my understanding based on the proposal, this is likely to be demolished. And in essence, the petitioner is asking for the approval of this board, to create a non-conforming subdivision that would have 41 feet of frontage where ordinarily you'd have, 60 feet and, maximum area up to 3895 square feet where 6,000. Would be the minimums. One particular point here that I would like to point out, this is the city's affordable housing developer, and there has been an approval by the Metropolitan Planning Commission at its last meeting on a text amendment to permit affordable housing. You might recall several months ago, we kind of had another request where we had a little bit of disagreement over whether or not the current provisions of the ordinance would permit this board or any board to reduce lot area for residential units, in essence. And so the determination that we got, in essence, was for single-family detached. A lot area per unit was not the way to view that. So I will add that in. But moving forward, and perhaps a little bit more relevant, is kind of this idea that as we're evaluating reductions of some of our standards, a relaxation, it should be on the basis of provision of affordable housing. And so I wanted to bring this point forward. That's why we had that reordering in the agenda, just to understand staff's position is that if we're going to relax standards, there should be some public benefit in return. And so this agency is committed to affordable housing. So, again, this has not been adopted by City Council, but it was approved by the MPC at its last meeting on October 15th, 2024. And so, again, on that basis, staff is recommending approval. In that the public benefit to be derived from this is likely to outweigh any detriment. And I am happy to answer any questions you may have.
Well, Mr. Go ahead with the same question.
Edward, I'm a little confused. If it's the MPC can't change a rule without the approval of the City Council, no?
They can't. It has to be adopted by City Council.
Right. So they made a recommendation, but it's up to council still to.
So we still can't do this.
Okay. Well, again, I'm
based on what we discussed a couple months ago, it says it's very clear. It's not variable. I would like to do it. Don't misunderstand me, but I think what we need to do is push this thing off and get it before City Council. I think they would agree to it. It makes perfect sense.
Absolutely.
But for us to give a variance, the first person who puts their hand in the air with the folks over at the building department, it's non-variable. It's right there.
Only because in this particular instance, in the previous case where we dealt with this, the zoning administrator determined that the standard did not apply to single family detached. I think that's kind of the understanding that we came to. So if this were a scenario where multiple units were proposed on a single lot, then the lot area per unit would not be variable. That particular case, the variance relief was approved on the basis that this is a single family detached. But again, to provide and kind of interject into the conversation, the logic that if we're relaxing standards, it should be on the basis of public benefit, specifically provision of affordable housing. So right. In this case, we have seen variances of this nature approved.
This is Pamela Everett. Additionally, the affordable housing piece is something that we're working with the city on, and it was brought to the MPC by the city. They made a presentation at the last meeting regarding affordable housing, and so that's going to be on the city council's agenda.
I think that the MPC made the right ruling. Don't misunderstand me.
Right.
I just don't want to approve something that then gets overturned later on down the line, because all we're doing is hurting these folks.
Understood.
Do you know what I mean? And so my concern is not about the subdivision and so on, which I would happily do. The question really becomes, do we have the legal right to do it? Mr. Bolton, do you have an opinion on this?
It's my understanding that the lot density does not apply to single family residents, only multifamily. From conversations I've had with John and Bridget in the last month or so.
So when it comes down to Edward, would you roll back to where it talks about the actual law itself, that little highlighted? Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. So a variance shall not be granted to permit a lot area per unit that is less than the minimum lot area per unit permitted by the zoning district in which the property affected by the variance is located.
It doesn't mention anything about single family or multiple or anything.
Yeah, it doesn't.
Well,
is the interpretation of the building, because this is important.
This is the interpretation of the
building department. It's only for multifamilies. Yes. So we're not going to get pushback from the building department if we approve this for these guys and they do a subdivision, because you all have to still sign off on it.
Well, my department, Planning and Urban Design, will actually look at the size of the lot and everything, as long as it meets the setback requirements and all. And that language is in the process of
being modified,
and like I say, it should be going before council. I don't know if it's today, but coming up soon.
Okay, all right. I just didn't want to create a problem for somebody, Edward. That's the reason for this. You know what I mean? We're trying to help folks in the affordable housing sector for obvious reasons.
I think your point still stands with the information that's been given, that council's got to adopt this.
I wonder if we could approve it today pending council adoption, or what are you thinking, Edward? What is your opinion?
So again, I spent some time thinking about these things. Previously, this board did approve that request, and I am fully in agreement with your interpretation of it. Hence the staff's recommendation on the next case that is to follow. Nonetheless, in kind of looking at what has happened here, what's transpired, and understanding the dynamic between the city and MPC, I think this is appropriate at this time, just given who the applicant is.
All right. I mean, I think if everybody's on the same page and this guy's not going to show up at the building department and they'll say, we're not going to approve the subdivision, and then he has to start all over again because we're waiting for the city. As long as everybody's on the same page, I think it's correct.
Sure. Well, possibly if you make the motion that if it is a motion to approve, you had a good point that it's contingent upon the adoption of the text amendment by council.
Okay. Yeah.
Any other questions for staff? Thank you, Edward.
Yes, sir.
Would the petitioner please come forward? Is petitioner here?
Ms. Dixon may not be here, but she is a city. She's not a city employee, but she works for the city in essence.
Yeah, no.
I think she would be comfortable with you all moving forward, even in her absence. They were also a part of the conversation in drafting the standards. So the provisions that are moving forward are only kind of the zoning and public facing side. There's a city policy on the backside with regard to finance that they are, Martin Freddy's department is working with them in conjunction. So
not only is she given up her chance to present her case, she's given up a chance to rebut public comment if there should be any.
That is an excellent point. If you don't mind, just 1 second. I'm going to phone a friend. She's not going to help me win a million today. So,
let's continue this until the next meeting.
Yeah.
Is it on the agenda today?
Edwin, is it on the agenda today, to your knowledge, this text amendment? It is not.
No, it should be on the next meeting 2 weeks from now.
It'll be on before we come back.
I think maybe we should postpone the thing.
Are you making a motion or just
expressing
opinion?
No, I'm a board discussion.
Ah.
Yeah, board discussion. What do you think?
I think it should go. I think we should continue it.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, because the text amendment can get before the city council, then we don't have to feel like we're doing something that we're not allowed to do. I'm going to make a motion that we postpone till the next meeting. That'll give the city time to address the text amendment and Miss Smith Dixon the opportunity to come before us.
I'll notify her.
Mr. Condon has made a motion to continue this item until the next meeting. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Mr. Turner. Is there any discussion? Mr. Griffith, how do you vote?
Yes.
Mr. Turner?
Yes.
Mr. Condon?
Yes.
Mr. Ball?
Yes.
All right, the motion passes and this item is continued. Next, we're going to hear 1918 Delaware Avenue, variance for lot size and setbacks, 24-005061. Edward, is this the same petitioner?
This is not the same petitioner. Okay. This is a similar request by a petitioner who, and admittedly, I did not have a pre-application conference with this particular petitioner. But this is a request that, you know, nonetheless, we received in a timely manner. It was advertised. But to my knowledge, there is no kind of commitment to affordability along the lines of what we've discussed. So just to briefly go through the facts here, Petitioner at 1918 Delaware Avenue is requesting a variance to the minimum lot area required to subdivide a parcel for new single-family detached home in the RSF 6 zoning district. Approval of the requested variances would create two lots. One of them would have 6,000 square feet, and the second one, which would contain the existing dwelling on the parcel, would have 5,451 square feet. So not far off, but still deficient with regard to the minimum 6,000 square foot requirement, and thus non-conforming. The non-conforming parcel, in addition to being deficient in area, would be deficient in its frontage, having only 50 feet where 60 feet is the minimum that is permitted within this district. You can kind of see from the street view image here, this is the existing structure that's on the parcel, built in or about 1940, according to the tax assessor. And there is some additional space here. The hardship that the petitioner kind of indicated was that there is a drainage ditch that traverses the property. And so that was the justification. Actually, Mr. Ulm kind of provided a really good context. So there's property that is adjoining his property, though it's public right of way. And so it makes his corner lot just by virtue of what it is. We give a little bit of buffer and cushion on the corner of those lots in order to prevent, I don't know, cars from, you know, coming on the parcel, any number of things. There's reasons why that space is left there. I'd say that this is similar. This is something that adjoins a space where there's obviously an easement for some sort of public use. And so this is not necessarily just excess space, right? I'd like to enter the staff report into the record. So again, referring to the standards that we spoke briefly about just a moment ago, staff is exactly of the opinion that Mr. Condon stated, that the ordinance does not give any board the ability to vary lot area per unit. And so for that reason, and again, because there is no commitment to alignment with this affordable housing program, which would then open the door to those relaxed development standards, staff is recommending denial of this particular request, simply because, again, this would not meet the minimums that are set by the zoning ordinance, and it's inconsistent with the zoning ordinance. So in this case, I'm happy to answer any questions you may have. I'll leave you with this image of the proposed subdivision. You can see this is the deficient lot, which would contain the existing dwelling. This is the new one that would adjoin that ditch.
Thank you, Edward. Is there any questions for staff? All right. Would the petitioner please come forward? State your name for the record.
Good morning, Board. My name is Ben Bloomley. A couple things I do want to point out. In regards to the lot and the frontage size, just on a quick Sages aerial map, within a block radius, we were able to find a number of other single family homes with less than 60 foot frontage. I don't have it on the computer, but this is the subject property. I mean, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, and even the adjacent property on the other side of the drainage ditch has less than 50 or less than 60 foot frontage as well. But speaking to the comments that were made, I also want to bring up a few things. We are committed to the affordable housing, and we actually ran a number of statistics and why we feel that this would be important for this given area. Oh, yes, ma'am. So to give you guys perspective, in a mile radius of the subject property that we're planning on building, under 350,000, there are two available housing options for purchase that are three beds, two baths. In the zip code of 31404, currently, three beds, two baths, under 350,000, there are seven available homes. So we are committed to keeping that affordable housing. We feel it's a big part of why we feel that, you know, we should hopefully be granted that variance, is to offer more affordable housing in the immediate area.
Thank you, sir. Any questions for petitioner?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Unfortunately, we are not able to help you today because we are restricted by the ordinance. But if you're talking about the possibility of affordable, I'm going to make a recommendation that you either request that we move this to a different date, or you temporarily withdraw your application to be resubmitted at a future date so that we don't have to deny it. We will have to deny it based on the ordinance, and then you'll have to wait a year.
Okay.
So my recommendation to you, and it's entirely up to you what you do, is that you request a continuance?
We would request, yeah, we'd like to request the continuance. So.
Okay.
Let's see. Would someone like to make a motion?
I make a motion that we accept the applicant's request for continuance and push this back to the next meeting.
All right. Mr. Condon has made a motion to continue this to the next meeting for obvious reasons. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Turner. Any discussion? Mr. Ball, how do you vote?
Yes.
Mr. Condon?
Yes.
Mr. Turner?
Yes.
Mr. Griffin?
Yes.
All right. Motion passes and this item is continued until the next. We didn't really set a date till the next meeting.
We'll go to the next meeting and then it's not. It's
okay. Okay.
So it's yeah. Just
okay. Next is 615 East 45th. This is a variance and relief of non-conforming uses and structures. 24-005032.
All right, Heather, forgive me. This is a petition that was continued previously. It was withdrawn just maybe the day before the meeting. So I'm sorry, I'm giving you background thinking perhaps there was a brief discussion of it, but Heather Spigner, I don't know why I never learned to say her name properly. I apologize, Heather, has submitted on behalf of Justin and Emily Danron at 615 East 45th Street for the expansion of an existing non-conforming accessory structure that's in the rear yard of the property. And so there are a couple of variances that are required in order to permit that expansion. Relief from non-conformity, in essence, because the structure is sitting on the rear property line and it is also on the side property line. And so this is a petitioner that came forward with the process initially and attempted to kind of work with us. And it was pulled at the very last minute because there were some issues with the neighbor. There's an adjoining neighbor. And of course, this is a similar discussion that we had just the last meeting about the challenges that you see in expanding structures that are on the property lines. And the petitioner has returned with a modified concept. So just to add, it was delayed the first time for the purpose of allowing this designer to go back and to try and reach a compromise. And so you can see the aerial there. This is a 6,300 square foot property that is conforming within the RSF 6 district. It's in the Ardsley Park, Chatham Crescent Conservation District. The lot is presently developed as a single family detached residence built in or about 1930 per the tax assessor. And it does have that non-conforming accessory structure in the rear yard. The petitioner is proposing to construct an upper story living space. Actually, this is not an accessory dwelling unit. It would not contain a kitchen. It only has a bathroom and it has kind of like a living space or a bedroom, if you will, on top of what is a garage. And so it is conforming with regard to that 40% maximum for the floor area for an accessory in relation to the principal on the parcel. And again, it would not be considered an ADU because of its lack of a kitchen. I will call your attention to the special circumstance. Given that this is within a conservation district, I'm not sure, but there's the possibility that this could be a contributing structure. Actually, the historic preservation staff happens to be here. Contributing, do we happen to recall? Haven't looked at it. Okay. So there are obviously provisions for the protection of structures that are regarded as contributing within this district. So where it's feasible, ideally you would see expansion of existing things as long as we're not ideally increasing nonconformities or creating bad situations for people. And so on that basis, staff does recommend approval of the requested vertical expansion, and I am happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Morrow. Is there any questions for staff?
Sorry to be the question man today. The I just want to be clear because the SAGIS map is never accurate. This particular garage, is it currently on the lane side property line?
Lane.
That's what if you go back to the map, I'm just sure. A little bit confused as to where it actually sits on the property line. Yeah.
Yes.
Because if you look, if the white line that goes around the block is accurate, mm-hmm. then you can see that it appears as though all these homes, none of them have garages. Oh, wait a minute. I'm looking at the wrong side. There we go. So the guy next door. All right. And then it's all hidden by trees.
Yep.
So it's sitting in the corner on the lot line on both corner, on both sides.
That is my understanding.
Yes, okay. Mm-hmm. That's all I just needed to understand that.
Yep.
Okay.
And that makes it non-conforming, and the only expansion is going to be a vertical expansion.
That's correct. So this would be, if it were a completely conforming structure to be built today, it would need to be 3 feet off the lane and 5 feet off the side property.
Exactly. Okay. Thank you, sir.
Any other questions for staff? All right, would the petitioner please come forward?
Hello, Heather Spagner.
Good morning. Do you have anything you'd like to say?
So, again, as you noted, it is an existing structure on two property lines. And yes, we're just requesting to go up. We've worked through a couple design variations, and we believe this one meets the concerns of the neighbors that we previously withdrew the petition and still is meeting the design that my clients would like to do.
Any questions for a petitioner?
So you've met with the neighbors, especially the one whose yard you're going to have to work out of to build this thing, right?
Yes, we met with them previously for the previous design when we prior to withdrawing. So they were not willing to allow construction over their property side. So this design is now addressing that concern on their side.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Any other questions for the petitioner? Thank you very much, ma'am. Are there any members of the public that wish to speak? I don't have any comment cards. Anybody online? Okay. We'll enter into board discussion. Mr. Ball, do you have anything you'd like to say? No. Mr. Condon?
No, sir.
Mr. Turner?
No.
Mr. Griffith?
No.
Someone care to make a motion?
I motion that we approve the variance.
All right. Mr. Turner has made a motion to approve the variance and relief of nonconforming structure. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Griffith. Is there any discussion? All right, Mr. Griffith, how do you vote?
Yes.
Mr. Turner?
Yes.
Mr. Condon?
Yes.
And Mr. Ball?
Yes.
All right. Motion passes and relief is granted. Next, we're going to hear 303 West 36. Relief for nonconforming uses and structures 24-005287.
All right, Mr. Chair, this is a very similar case. The petitioners Shannon Perry and Shannon Perry Taylor and Kevin O'Keefe at 303 West 36th Street. Again, very similar facts in that we have a nonconforming accessory structure that is on, it has some setback on that side. I'll get to that. You can see the aerial here. This is at the intersection of Jefferson and West 36th Lane. And I do believe that this is a fire damaged structure. And I believe that this petitioner acquired, the property and, is seeking to expand this rear structure. And it does require that approval in order to increase the nonconformity, even though there's not any proposal to expand on either side. This is just a vertical. So just to run through some of these facts here, subject property is just over 7,000 square feet, currently zoned TN2, and it is conforming with regard to its area and frontage for the current use. The property is within the Streetcar Local Historic District. And it's related to HPC application 23005180-COA. That report notes that this particular structure is non-contributing within this district. And so it's presently developed as a single-family detached home built in or about 1900, and that accessory structure is non-conforming. I believe it has a 3-foot side setback, but it is on the rear it is on the rear property line. And so the petitioner is proposing to construct an upper story living quarters atop the existing accessory structure. It is conforming with regard to that 40% maximum floor area in relation to the principal. And per the submitted plans, the structure will remain lower in height than the principal building. So while this might not necessarily, in that this is not a contributing structure, be consistent with the intent of the zoning ordinance, ideally what we would see is that this is something that you would knock it down and build something that is completely conforming to be honest with you. But this is consistent with other provisions of the zoning ordinance, namely preservation and expansion of existing structures is likely to be consistent with resource preservation objectives, which is something that we are kind of looking more at as we head toward a new comprehensive plan update. So it is consistent with some policies, inconsistent with others. Nonetheless, staff is comfortable giving a recommendation of approval for this vertical expansion. And just to show you, this is what would result. You can see that this is the peak of the roof of the existing structure. And so after the fact, this is where the height of the other one would rest, and this is the living area that would be added. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Marvin. Any questions for staff? All right. Thank you very much, sir. Would a petitioner please come forward?
Good morning, Board.
Good morning.
I'm Shannon Taylor, the owner of the property, and we've been working to create this guest house since February. So we would, it's come to our attention that you needed a variance to change the purpose of the building. Obviously, the lower level is still going to be parking. We're just hoping to expand upward and create a guest space.
Thank you very much. Is there any questions for petitioner?
I do have some examples of photographs of other properties along the same block that show the
That was just noise from outside.
Okay. Show the buildings that are built on the property line that are existing there. So it's precedent that it's already there and they're all rental properties.
Okay. Are there any questions for the petitioner?
Do you have any problem with the restrictions that the staff has listed as recommendations? Have you seen this?
The staff recommendations that we've already met?
No, there's a list of staff recommendations. Edward, do you have that? Oh, I'm sorry, Ed was not here. The if we could scroll up to that.
About the gutters.
About the gutters, that gutters be installed to prevent stormwater. No problem.
Okay.
We're happy to do that.
Just want to make sure.
Yes,
thank
sir.
You.
Thank you.
Any other
I
questions?
Apologize. I haven't seen this. So, okay, thank you.
Any other questions for the petitioner? Thank you, ma'am. Are there any members of the public that wish to speak concerning this petition? Are there any online?
No, sir.
All right. Well, we'll enter into board discussion. Mr. Griffith, do you have anything you'd like to say?
No.
Mr. Turner?
No.
Mr. Condon?
No, sir.
Mr. Ball?
No.
Someone care to make a motion?
I motion that we approve the requested relief.
Okay, Mr.
With conditions.
With conditions of the gutters be installed.
All right, Mr. Turner has made a motion to approve the request for relief as per staff recommendations with the gutters being installed. Is there a second to the motion?
Second.
Second by Mr. Condon. Any discussion? Mr. Ball, how do you vote?
Yes.
Mr. Condon?
Yes.
Mr. Turner?
Yes.
Mr. Griffith?
Yes.
Okay, the motion passes and the request for relief is granted. Next, we're going to hear 637 East Anderson Street. This is a variance and relief from nonconforming existing structure. 24-005288.
Mr. Chair, this is a request by Joshua Yellen of Hunter McLean on behalf of Cash Cat Enterprises, 637 East Anderson Street. And the petitioner is requesting the approval to construct an accessory structure on this property that is in excess of the 40% maximum floor area that would ordinarily be permitted. And this is actually to construct a garage so that there could be parking for the 5-unit apartment building that has been present on this lot since 1900. I didn't know that it was that old, but when you see it, you'll You'll realize, yeah. It says renovated in or about 1970 by the tax assessor. But basically, this is a building that contains five units, and it was not constructed with off-street parking. And so this is a request just to build a parking garage. The thing that makes this unique is that this is a non-conforming building. And so this is in a district that would permit a residential unit with a residential building with up to four dwelling units in it. This one contains five. So again, just short by 12% of the 1,800 square feet per unit that's required, but still non-conforming within the context of the current development scheme with regards. So again, this is a building that was built in 1900. It predates any of these standards. But for that, I probably would have asked that this be put on consent. Staff does recommend approval of this request. I'd like to enter the staff report into the record, but show you this is the proposed garage. It is intended to meet all of the pertinent setbacks that are associated with this zoning district. So no other issues here other than its size to accommodate five cars, one per unit, which actually increases conformity. That makes sense.
Right. Is there any questions for staff? Right. Thank you, Mr. Morrow. Mr. Yellen, I see you're already coming forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Josh Yellen. I don't have much to add, but this is bringing a five-car garage to a five-unit building. It's bringing an amenity for the tenant space. It meets the lot coverage requirements. It meets the setback requirements, and we would respectfully request that you approve of the same.
Thank you, sir. Any questions for the petitioner? All right. Are there any members of the public that wish to speak? Ma'am, please come forward and state your name for the record. And please remember to, in the future, fill out a speaker card.
Yes, thank you. I want to verify that the entrance to the garage
please,
will be from the lane.
Please state your name for the record.
Wood.
Thank you.
So go ahead. Mrs. Wood?
I'd like to verify that the entrance to the garage will be from the lane.
The
is that correct?
Is shaking his head in the affirmative, so yes.
Okay. I say that because sometimes we give variances to the street entrance to a garage, and if you have a lane, the design of the Oglethorpe plan, which is also used in other neighborhoods, allows you to use lanes to enter. If you enter from the street, you remove growth for shrubbery and all, and you put concrete. We did that recently with an approval of somebody, and they took out a lot of green, and they put in concrete at the sidewalk level. And now when you go down the street, there's not only the concrete instead of the growth of trees and bushes, but you also have cars parked right there. So let's keep the border green and use the lanes when we can. And thank you for doing that.
Thank you, Mrs. Wood. Any other members of the public wish to speak? All right, Mr. Yellen, would you like to rebut public comment or respond?
I'll just quickly state that all access for vehicles to this garage will be through the line.
Thank you, sir. All right, Mr. Griffith, do you have anything you'd like to say?
No, sir.
Mr. Turner?
No.
Mr. Condon?
No, sir.
Mr. Ball?
No.
All right. In that case, would someone like to make a motion?
I make a motion that we accept staff recommendation and approve the requested variance for the five-car garage.
All right. Mr. Condon has made a motion to approve the variance. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Ball. Any discussion? Mr. Ball, how do you vote?
Yes.
Mr. Condon?
Yes.
Mr. Turner?
Yes.
And Mr. Griffith?
Yes.
Okay. The motion passes. And variance is approved. Next, we're going to hear 511 Vincent Avenue, variance and relief of nonconforming uses and structures, 24-005224.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Edward Morrow again. The petitioner is requesting a series of variances in association with a proposal to convert and expand an existing non-conforming accessory structure into an accessory dwelling unit at 511 Vinson Avenue. These variances include relief for a non-conforming rear setback of 0 feet, a non-conforming side setback of 3.5 feet, and to permit 7 feet of separation from the principal dwelling unit where the minimum is 10, right? And so I'll just add, I am a little unclear myself as to whether or not this is whether there's an intent to actually improve the structure that's existing or to build only in its footprint, having removed what's there. Nonetheless, I just want to insert that into the record so that the board may ask the petitioner, and the outcome is more or less the same. This is the appropriate venue to address either one. So this is the subject property on the screen right here. And if you can see my cursor, the intent is to either demolish and rebuild or improve the structure that is right here. And ultimately, you can see that it is right on those property lines, and it is going to expand this structure so that it comes just a bit closer to the house, leaving only 7 feet where 10 feet is required. And I am confident that that configuration is required to accommodate all the necessary components of an accessory dwelling unit. So just to give you a little bit of background, the property is zoned RSF5, and it does have land access. The current land use is a single family residence that is about 1,342 square feet. And the 6,300 square foot parcel and structure are both conforming. That's the principal structure. The subject parcel and the object of the variance is a detached garage that was built in 1970 per the tax assessor. It's 20 by 22, so about 440 square feet. And the petitioner is requesting variance relief in order to expand this structure. It does fall within the permitted 40% maximum floor area for ADUs. However, it does have some non-conforming setbacks. And so just so you can see, you would have this original 440 square foot structure. This is the addition. You can see it's a bathroom and shower that is going to bring it within 7 feet of the principal dwelling. There's a sidewalk here, and this is actually the rear of the dwelling. This is the driveway. You would pull into the garage. And so this is intended to be the totality of the living quarters. So you can see. So in looking at this, I will actually run through these criteria. The requested variance is inconsistent with the intent of the zoning ordinance, but again, it's consistent with resource preservation if the intent is indeed to restore what is there or to improve it rather than to demolish. But again, this is not a situation where we're talking about a contributing structure or anything of that nature. So ideally, the zoning ordinance would intend that this be demolished and that a completely conforming structure be built in its place. The only special condition here is that we are talking about the potential repurposing of an existing structure. The special condition is the result of the actions of the petitioner. They are desiring to improve something that would otherwise be legal nonconforming. And so the request is not likely fully financially motivated, though obviously there are financial implications for the inclusion of an accessory dwelling unit on the property. Literal interpretation of the regulations would not deprive the applicant of rights commonly enjoyed by similarly situated properties. The parcel is of sufficient area to establish an ADU by right. And so there is the opportunity to come back to this board. Actually, you would need to come back to this board with a design that conforms to the requirements of the zoning ordinance, particularly with regard to separation, because that then would become incumbent upon the building department to specify how it is the structure would need to be built to meet its requirements. So the variance is not required to make use of the subject property. And again, a conforming ADU may be developed by right by this petitioner. Approval of the variance would confer special privilege. With that, staff does recommend denial of this particular request, and I am happy to answer any of your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Morrow. Any questions for staff?
Edward, the denial is mostly based on the 7 foot distance between the house and the addition, or?
So again, we're not in a district of any sort, not in a preservation oriented district. This is a general RSF5. And so that was the first consideration. Again, this is a place where you can build a conforming ADU by right. There's right. No need for the 125% relief. And again, I brought the point up that I don't know if this is an intent to restore or to rebuild in the footprint. If the intent is to rebuild in the footprint, a conforming structure ideally would be built.
Okay. So, thank you, sir.
Sure. Thank you. Any other questions for staff? Thank you very much, sir. Would the petitioner please come forward? Just come to the podium, please. State your name for the record.
Hi. I go by Trish, but legal name is Tui Jang. My husband's also here. We are the owners of this property. We inherited it in 2022.
Jared Ross from resident.
Yeah. So we are the owners. We're trying to improve it. This is for family use only. We have my mom living with us. So this is like our extended either guest room or expanded space for a workshop. We are trying to accommodate her for the living quarters. That's why we're asking for an ADU. That's with the kitchen and everything. And so that area that you're seeing right here is actually the deck. So it's actually not the building itself, but it's an outdoor space. And the 7 feet is the corner of the house is right here. So it's not even that close to the house. So that this is what we would like you to consider is that we have talked. I have talked with several people throughout this whole discussion on if that is allowable. So we are trying to improve an existing structure that has already been there and trying to expand it.
We're keeping three walls basically of the building and just moving.
So the so you're going to keep the three walls that comprise the, looking at this photo, the left side of the garage. And
yeah, all of the garage is staying the same. Right. The only two walls that we're trying to redo is this wall and this wall, because that one is to expand with the bathroom. So we would need to kind of rebuild that wall for the bathroom. And then this side is to redo the windows. So currently there's three windows that are unusable. They're at a weird height where you can't even look out of them very well. You can't open and close them very well. and we're proposing one big window for this space so that it is usable for my mom or whoever if we have guests over.
You're not in the historic district, so the windows don't really matter.
Okay. That's the only reason why we're doing that wall.
This area that's highlighted, that's the proposed living area. Does that part of the structure exist and it's just a proposed bathroom that doesn't exist?
Correct. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I just want to make sure that you understand that if you demolish, is it 50%, Tom? What's the rule if they demolish to X that they have to conform to the current zoning?
Well, if they take the walls out that are non-conforming,
yep.
Then they'd have to put them back conforming.
So the non-conforming walls are the ones that are the current garage space. Is that correct? That's where you're touching the property line?
Yeah. So the back wall is non-conforming and this side wall, but okay. We are not touching those at all.
So the variance then, Tom, is for them to put the non-conforming wall back in its non-conforming place if they adjust it. But as long as they don't demolish.
As long as they don't take that wall down. Right.
We just want to make sure that you're clear on that because when you do, the building department will make you change.
Right.
Okay, so make sure your builder understands this.
Yes.
All right.
They do. Okay. And then the last part was that we are raising the roof to have a pitch to make sure the water flows.
Any other questions for petitioner? Thank you very much. Are there any members of the public that wish to speak? Y'all can sit down. Anyone online? All right.
No, sir.
Mr. Ball, do you have anything you'd like to say?
No.
Mr. Condon. Oh, go ahead. Who's it for?
Could you all come back up for a second? The roof height, I just want to make sure you understand that the roof height of your ADU cannot be higher than the roof height of your home.
Yes.
So when he changes the roof line, don't let him do that either, because you'll be coming back here and we'll be telling you to take the roof off.
Yeah, it's well under. Because this is actually set under.
Okay. Yep. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else you want to add?
No, sir.
Okay. Mr. Turner?
No comments.
Mr. Griffith?
No, sir.
All right. Would someone care to make a motion?
I make a motion that we approve the variance request for the nonconformity and additional space. Thank you. Thank you, Edward. For relief of the nonconformity rear setback, relief of the nonconformity side setback, and to permit 7-foot separation from the principal dwelling unit.
Okay. Mr. Condon has made a motion to grant relief for the rear setback, the side setback, and to permit the 7-foot separation from the principal dwelling unit. Is there a second to the motion?
Second.
Second by Mr. Ball. Any discussion? Mr. Ball, how do you vote?
Yes.
Mr. Condon?
Yes.
Mr. Turner?
Yes.
And Mr. Griffith?
Yes.
All right. Motion passes and reliefs and variances are granted. I'd like to take a very short 5-minute recess, please.
Yeah, I'm good.
Everybody's good?
We're all good.
Thank God.
Yeah.
I might make one for you.
All right. Next, we're going to hear 225 West 40th Street, variances for accessory dwelling unit 24-004558.
Turned off my microphone. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the board, Edward Morrow here. So this is another case that has somewhat similar facts as the last one that we just heard, but in this instance, there is an intent to demolish what is an existing accessory structure. It's a garage that fronts on, this is Jefferson Street, at the rear of a contributing historic dwelling. In essence, the petitioner is requesting for relief from the 40% maximum floor area for an accessory dwelling unit in relation to the principal dwelling. Again, the intent is to take the accessory structure that's at the rear of this contributing dwelling in the historic district and to replace it. And that expansion is proposed to exceed what would be the maximum of 40% in relation to the principal dwelling on the parcel. Subject parcel is plus or minus 6,000 square feet. It is zoned TN2. Little bit of a conflict here. TN2, traditional neighborhood 2. And it does have principal frontage there, as you can see, on West 40th Street. But this garage has access here off of Jefferson Street. And so the property does contain a contributing two-story home that is 1,642 square feet in area. The detached garage is non-contributing, thereby permitting its demolition. For all who are interested, this is in the Streetcar Historic Overlay District. It is resource number 1401. And the request indicates an intent to expand the size and function of this non-contributing garage by extending its footprint partially toward the house while maintaining compliance with the current rear and side setbacks. So really the only thing that's at issue here is the size of it, right? And the idea is that because we are creating something that was not there, then we can make it conforming with the current specifications of the zoning district. And so the proposed 675 square foot structure would be 49.6% of the floor area of the principal dwelling, where again, only 40% is permitted. So I will not go through these criteria again because of that similarity. We're familiar. This is an existing condition, but this petitioner is taking the structure to an extent that is beyond that prior nonconformity, and they're seeking to expand it. And it's on that basis that staff does recommend denial of the request, again, because there is the opportunity to create something that is conforming within this district. I know I went through that quickly. I am happy to answer any questions you all have.
Thank you, Mr. Morrow. Any questions for staff?
So it's just the square footage. We don't have to address anything to do with the setbacks.
No, sir.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Morrow.
Yes.
Would petitioner please come forward?
Hello, Pete Callejas, Homestead Architecture. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, appreciate your consideration. A couple things. The structure that's being demolished is non-contributing. It's a CMU building that's irreparably damaged. It's really too small for a two-car garage. It's very low. It's very narrow. The client wants to do a two-car garage with a small apartment above. It's less than 700 square foot apartment above. The reasonable difficulty we're claiming is that the house, this existing house that's on the lot, is actually, based on the calculations that I got from the zoning department, it's actually only 1,360 heated square feet on the first floor, which is very small for that lot and for that neighborhood. And that's one of the reasons why if it was 327 feet bigger, we wouldn't have to be here. But because it's only 1,360 square foot, heated square foot on the first floor, that would only allow us 544 square feet for a two-car garage, which is relatively small for a two modern size. I think the minimum, I don't have it written here, but, 24 by 24. The size also has to do with the apartment above, which is a one-bedroom apartment can be anywhere from 600 to 800 square feet. We're going to 675. It's not anything unreasonable. It's just a one-bedroom apartment with a studio space for a young professional or a student long-term lease rental. The lot, it's 200% the minimum size for that TN2. It's 160% wider than it needs to be. It's under 700 square feet. There are several examples across the street, catty corner, and within a couple hundred feet where accessory dwelling units are larger than the 40%, including one that was approved by this board at 306 West 40th, which is 250 feet over the allowable. So all we're asking for really is just a little bit of an exemption because of the size, really having more to do with the size of the existing house than the lot. I think with what we're proposing, we're going to end up with 33% lot coverage of the 60% that's allowed. So the building that was demolished was not historic. It was not contributing. It was irreparable damage. What we're trying to do is just a two-car garage with a medium-sized apartment above. That's it. So I'm here to answer any questions if you have.
Thank you, sir. Any questions for petitioner? Right. Any members of the public that would like to speak? Are there any online?
No, sir.
All right. Thank you. So, Mr. Ball, do you have anything you'd like to add?
I mean, it seems close to conforming, and, we'd be sort of slippery slope back to making it a one-car garage and taking parking off the site. So I'm sort of in favor, but, that seems close to working.
Mr. Condon?
No, sir.
Mr. Turner?
No comments.
Mr. Griffith?
No, sir.
Someone care to make a motion?
I motion we approve the requested variance.
Mr. Barr has made a motion to approve the requested variance. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Turner. Any discussion on the motion? All right. Mr. Barr, how do you vote?
Yes.
Mr. Condon?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Turner?
Yes.
And Mr. Griffith?
Yes.
All right. Motion passes and variance is approved. Next, we're going to hear 2309 Waltz Drive, variance to lot size reduction for accessory dwelling unit. 24-005292.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. This is Edward Morrow again. The petitioner, Karen Dickinson, is requesting relief from the 125% lot area minimum required to establish an accessory dwelling unit. The subject property is 2309 Waltz Avenue. You can see the aerial imagery here on your screen. Subject property is RSF 10. This is a minimum of 10,000 square feet in land area in a district that permits only residential single-family detached homes. The structure is about 1,509 square feet, and so this isn't really a concern with regard to size necessarily. The parcel is 102%, where a minimum of 125% is required. The only concern that we had in reviewing this is that the structure that may have been proposed, it might be a prefab structure of a type that might face issues when they get to the building department with regard to citing it for an ADU. There is a provision within the ordinance that says that manufactured homes, shipping containers, recreational vehicles, and travel trailers shall not be used as accessory dwelling units, except that manufactured homes may be used in specified zoning districts, in essence. And the structure that was proposed appeared to be manufactured. So, again, that's something that will be sorted out with the building department. But the issue in question today is that of the minimum lot area, again, 102%, where 125% is the minimum that's required. Staff took no issue with that. This is the proposed configuration here. You can see it's intended to meet all of the necessary setbacks, and it is well below the lot coverage. With that, staff does recommend approval of this request, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
So to be clear, we're just talking about the variance that's asked for, not about what the building is, if whether it's manufactured or
that
anything
is correct.
Else about it.
I just want to make sure it's introduced into the record that we're right. Aware there may be questions with regard to this particular type of structure, and to just convey to the petitioner, this variance is to establish an ADU. We're not making any qualifications with regard to the appropriateness of this structure that you're intending to use.
Are there any questions for staff? All right. Thank you, Mr. Morrow. Would petitioner please come forward?
Good morning. My name is Karen Dickerson.
Good morning. Do you have anything you'd like to say?
Well, when I looked at other properties in the area, well, basically on my street, they have, I don't even know what to call it, because they actually look like they built them on their own. And so I knew that I didn't want to do that because of what theirs looked like. But I will promise you that mine will be done right. And I would like for y'all to grant this variance.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Anybody wish to speak concerning this? Any members of the public? One online?
No, sir.
Mr. Griffith, do you have anything you'd like to add?
No.
Mr. Turner?
No.
Mr. Condon?
No, sir.
Mr. Ball?
No.
Someone care to make a motion?
I motion that we approve the variance.
All right. Mr. Turner has made a motion to approve the requested variance. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Condon. Any discussion? Mr. Ball, how do you vote?
Yes.
Mr. Condon?
Yes.
Mr. Turner? Mr. Griffin?
Yes.
All right. Motion passes and variance is approved. Next, we're going to hear 1605 Abercorn Street. This is an appeal to a decision made by the HPC 24-005229.
I finally reached the items that I think everyone is here for. So, Mr. Chair, members of the board, this is an appeal of a request that went before the Historic Preservation Commission on August 28th, 2024. And the petitioner at that time requested evaluation of a request to demolish the subject property. You can see some photos here on your screen up at 1605 Abercorn Street. It was obviously fire damaged, and that was the basis of that request to say, please allow us to demolish this property and reconstruct something in its place. What is appealed is the fact that the Historic Preservation Commission voted to approve only a partial demolition, right? What they stated was an intent to permit replacement of only elements that were irreparably damaged, and they requested that anything that could be salvaged be stabilized for the purpose of its restoration, and that any items that were able to be salvaged and reused in other projects, that those be given, I'm assuming, to Repurpose Savannah, which is an organization that makes possible the acquisition of previously reclaimed historic materials for future projects. And so this was not exactly within the intent of the petitioner, and they requested that demolition in that I believe they expected in essence, permission to demolish the structure in its entirety. And so the petitioner is here today requesting that the determination of the HPC be modified to permit total demolition of the structures, and they assert that this restoration presents a significant financial burden. And so I'm going to go through staff's findings with regard to how we came to this conclusion. The subject parcel is TN2, Traditional Neighborhood 2. It's indicated as about 0.07 acres by the tax assessor, which is just over 3,000 square feet. It has 45 feet of frontage on Abercorn Street. It's very close to Sly's, which is a great restaurant. The parcel is within the Streetcar Local Historic District, and it contains what remains of a 2,676-square-foot single-family dwelling, built in or about 1900 and renovated in 1990 per the tax assessor. The home is listed as a contributing resource within the Thomas Square National Register Historic District, and it is within, again, the Streetcar Local Historic District. According to documentation that was provided by the petitioner, the home caught fire on Valentine's Day, of all days, or at least that is the date of the condemnation order that was issued by the City of Savannah. The appellant filed application for a COA for demolition for of a contributing structure to be heard at the August 24th. I'm recalling the 28th date. It was either August 24th or 28th, forgive me. In evaluating that request, MPC staff did cite the structural engineer's analysis of the property, which attested to the poor state of the structure following the fire. And they added that rot and decay, not attributable to the fire, of this historic wood frame structure posed an added burden, which would ultimately cost more and be of lesser quality than new construction. That was the finding of the structural engineer that was included with the documents that were sent up. MPC staff's report further noted that no information was provided demonstrating the cost of demolition versus restoration nor economic hardship. This was a note from MPC Historic Preservation staff from their staff report. MPC staff recommended approval of total demolition upon the condition that the building be documented in accordance with MPC's policy and that salvageable materials be collected for reuse. While the structure was condemned by the city, no demolition order has been issued by the city, and this is something that MPC staff has kind of followed up with the building department to kind of understand what the thinking was. To date, we have not received a demolition order, but again, you have seen included in the record the condemnation that was issued. Again, criteria for issuance of a COA, I will jump down here. For demolition, we're looking at B here, and in particular, relocation or demolition is required to avoid exceptional practical difficulty or undue hardship upon the owner, if all the following conditions are also satisfied. And the one that we're concerned with here, the applicant has provided evidence sufficient to demonstrate that the application of the standards of this section deprives the applicant of reasonable economic return on the subject property. And I'll go back to has provided evidence sufficient to demonstrate. In looking at this, I kind of relied on, again, staff's prior report stating that there was no information that had been provided about the costs that were associated with the total demolition of the structure, as opposed to actually going through and assessing and scoping the work that would be done involved in its restoration. In kind of looking at the documents that were provided, there was nothing so far as to suggest that this was in imminent danger of causing kind of public harm. They said it was in imminent danger of collapse, but that did not necessarily suggest There is something that is about to fall into a public right-of-way. There is something that is about to damage someone else's property. The language did not lead me to believe that that was the concern, at which point I believe building probably would have, or code enforcement would have taken the step to say, this needs to be demolished. There was no demolition order that was issued. And so on that basis, staff is finding that for their failure to provide sufficient information to establish deprivation of reasonable economic return, that the Historic Preservation Commission's determination be affirmed. So with that, I am happy to answer any questions you may have. Historic Preservation staff that has firsthand knowledge of kind of the lower board proceedings is here to answer any questions also.
Who used the language that it was in imminent danger of collapse? Who was that?
That would have been in the structural report, I believe.
This is the structural report submitted by the petitioner or by city staff?
A good question. So the structural engineering report was from an outside consultant. Actually, I should just go right here. Let's see. Oh, these are pictures. I'm so sorry. Wrong attachment. Just as Robert McCorkle would say, for some flavor. These are pictures of what the inside looks like. It's rough, admittedly. I'm going to take a second and go back, though, and I'm going to look for the submittal packet. Nope, that's the same thing. I clicked on the right one. Let's see if it's in here. It is not here. There is absolutely. Oh, it's at the bottom. Okay, I didn't go far enough. I'm sorry. I apologize. This sidebar thing does not help. I don't know if you can see that. I'm scrolling and it's just, I can't even get the. Okay, here we go. So RWP Engineering is the firm that issued this structural report. And so they stated the structure is a two-story wood stick frame residential building. And it kind of describes, says it was recently damaged by a fire that destroyed a significant portion. It talks about how it started.
And it is balloon framed in the upper portion, which means the studs go from the bottom all the way straight up. It's not platform framed. So half of this at least is pretty compromised.
Okay. I will jump down here to conclusions. In our opinion, the fire damaged front exterior wall pose a significant hazard and risk of collapse in its current condition. Furthermore, it is our opinion that given the significant portion of rot and decay of existing wood frame structure, a significant portion of fire damaged, the cost to repair the existing wood structure will greatly exceed the cost of demolition. So again, this is from the structural report, but it is not necessarily a scope with estimates of what that would actually take.
And with your follow-up with the city, you didn't get any response from the building department?
We had some verbal correspondence to the effect that there may have been, but again, we have lots of verbal correspondence with people.
Nothing official.
Right.
All right. And also, do you know what the recommendation of HPC staff was when this was heard at the board meeting?
I believe HPC staff was in agreement with the total demolition.
Okay. Any other questions for staff? All right. Thank you, sir.
Absolutely.
Would the petitioner please come forward? State your name for the record.
Hi. My name is Amy Brock. I'm the owner of the property. What questions do you have for me? He pretty much covered everything.
Well, first, there's nothing you want to add.
The home caught on fire. It's a complete disaster. We had thought that the HPC was going to approve full demolition, and now we're in a situation where the structure is so damaged that our contractor has stated that it will be far more expensive to build from what's there. Rather than demolishing and building something new. We are working with Repurpose Savannah already to carefully deconstruct and salvage whatever remains.
Okay. Any other questions for the petitioner?
It appears by the photographs that the majority of the damage is to the second floor in the attic.
Correct.
Right. I didn't see any photos of the first floor. What kind of condition is the first floor in other than water damage from them putting the fire out?
There's significant fire damage in the front half of the home.
I don't know if you caught the report. It's a balloon framed house.
Oh, okay. That second floor right there. And then this starts getting into the lower levels. This was noted by our structural engineer of having significant issues. Oh, I don't think the first floor photos are in there. There's some.
All right. Does anyone have any questions for the petitioner? All right. Thank you, ma'am. We have one member of the public that wishes to speak, Ellie Isaacs.
Hello, hello. Ellie Isaacs, Director of Preservation at Historic Savannah Foundation. We agree with staff's recommendation to uphold and affirm the decision made by the HPC. To overturn the decision will undermine the authority of the HPC. As staff noted, insufficient evidence was provided in the application to warrant a complete demolition or financial hardship. We took a similar approach to what was in the HPC determination on a revolving fund house on West 37th Street, known as the Webb House. So it is proven that it can be done. Why would we want to lose another contributing building to the district if it doesn't have to be lost? Taking sensitive steps to save as much of the contributing building as possible is the best approach.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Any other members of the public wish to speak? Are there any online?
No, sir.
All right. Ma'am, would you like to rebut public comment? Okay. We're going to enter into board discussion. Mr. Ball, do you have anything you want to say? Mr. Condon.
I've seen worse houses repaired. I hate to see, especially in Abercorn, houses, these historic homes, just demolished. As a builder, I personally have fixed houses worse than this. I sympathize with the applicant in the sense that it's always going to be easier and a builder and an engineer is always going to default to just push it over and start over again. But in Savannah, part of why we're all here is because we love these old houses, right? I mean, I'm torn. I'd like to hear everybody else's opinion.
Mr. Turner.
I think the financial comparison would have been extremely helpful in making a decision to go against the initial decision. And lack of that makes it hard for me to.
Do you want to give these guys some time to do that?
If possible, I think that would be.
Can the applicant come forward, please? If we give you some time, can you get your contractor to provide you with documentation that it's more expensive to repair the building than to knock it down?
Yes, and I have that. That should have been submitted with all of our package.
If you request a continuance, we can continue.
Mr. Congdon, you have to remember that this board can only consider what the board below considered. So we can't ask for additional evidence if it wasn't in the original package. then you can't consider it. So it has to be what the board below considered. So
thank you for that.
I don't know if that information, we didn't see that information in the original package.
Well, and I believe, in the original petition, there wasn't even a question of that, because we were kind of petitioning for full demolition anyway. So there was, the economic part was not part of the conversation until the HPC decision.
The economic part is always part of the application for demolition. It's part of it. If Edward, if you'll pull up the application so that you can show her, it is part of that.
Okay.
But I was just,
I didn't prepare that. I don't know what's.
This is the ordinance. So if you are requesting something, there's a door in the ordinance that says you can ask for X, Y, or Z. This is demolition. These are the criteria for demolition. Anytime that application is soliciting information, it's based on the requirements of this ordinance, first and foremost.
Okay.
Show what we received. Allow you to scroll through. This is your application.
Okay. Everybody see it? Are there any further questions for me?
I am so sorry. We have our historic preservation staff here. They can probably speak to and find the original application.
I just wanted to provide a little context. So this went before the historic, Jonathan Mellon, Director of Historic Preservation. This went before the HPC. There was quite a bit of discussion. A number of the members of the Historic Preservation Commission stated what I believe Mr. Condon just said, that they had seen a number of other historic buildings in Savannah. As we know, there are too many of them that catch on fire, it seems. It had been restored. They also noted that this fire occurred. Caitlin and Kelly and I went out there, I believe, February or March. So it's been standing for 8 months. It's been through a hurricane. We haven't seen any further deterioration. So I think that also, when the HPC looked at it, they said, we understand that the HPC acknowledged that, yes, it probably is more expensive to restore it, but it was their view that that's why they exist, is to preserve historic contributing buildings, and that, you know, this building should be restored.
Okay. And you, I asked Mr. Morrow, your recommendation was to grant demolition.
Yes, because our understanding from, no, we were recommending full demolition because, again, we always err on the side of public safety. So from what we had, our understanding from speaking with the applicant and speaking with the city at the time was that this building was potentially in imminent danger of collapsing, and even though there is a fence around it, falling onto the street. NBC staff, as Edward noted, has done, you know, had more conversations where actually demolition order has not been issued. Also, many, many more months have passed. The building is still there. It does not, you know, we haven't been able to go into the site. But a number of our HPC members, you know, visited the site. Not, they don't go on public, private property. They walked around the site outside of it. And it was their view that this, you know, the majority of the building actually is intact. And that the building could be restored. But we were erring on the side of public safety, which is what we always do, from the initial condemnation from the city. But then we discovered that afterwards that there had actually not been a demolition order issued by the city. So it's kind of been sitting there for, as I said, like 8 months.
What is your present opinion?
I believe our Historic Preservation Commission is comprised of folks who have a great deal of experience with historic buildings. I think in looking at it now, and given that the city has, I think just common sense, if, you know, the city had concerns that this building was going to collapse, they probably wouldn't have let it sit there for 8 months. And a number of members of the Historic Preservation Commission have noted that they've worked on buildings themselves. It had been in worse condition that they've restored. And as Ms. Isaacs noted, we always want to, where possible, you know, uphold the authority of HPC and HDBR.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
So, Mr. Turner, you finished with your comments?
No further comment.
Mr. Griffith?
No, I have none.
Do you fellas want to add anything in light of the testimony from Mr. Mellon?
No.
Okay. Would someone care to make a motion?
I'll make a motion that we... Edward, would you pull up your recommendation, please?
Yes.
I make a motion that we affirm the decision of the Historic Preservation Commission in regards to 1605 Abercorn Street.
Okay. Mr. Condon has made a motion to affirm the decision.
And Mr. Condon, can you be more specific in your motion? Because remember, we have to have findings of fact.
Do you want me to read into the record?
Yes, that would be.
I make a motion that we affirm the decision of the Historic Preservation Commission based on the fact that the appellant failed to provide sufficient information to establish deprivation of reasonable economic return.
Okay. Mr. Condon has made a motion to affirm the HPC decision because the applicant has not presented enough evidence to demonstrate that it would create a financial hardship. Is there a second to the motion?
Second.
Seconded by Mr. Ball. Any discussion on the motion? All right, Mr. Griffith, how do you vote?
Yes.
Mr. Turner?
Yes.
Mr. Condon?
Yes.
Mr. Ball?
Yes.
Okay, the motion passes and HPC decision is upheld. Next, we're going to hear 201 West Jones Street. This is an appeal to decision of Historic District Board of Review, 24-005030.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, members of the board, Edward Morrow again. With our final petition for today, this is an appeal by Mr. Jones, acting as an agent for Anna Habersham Wright of the Historic District Board of Review decision regarding 201 West Jones Street. Mr. Jones is appealing the August 14th, 2024 HDBR approval of a COA for a proposed rear addition to a historic residence and contributing structure at 201 West Jones Street. Again, this is with specific regard to COA 24-003810-COA. The modifications would extend to the second and third, floors of the residence, encapsulating the rear of the structure and effectuating the conversion of a third floor window to a door. The petitioner does propose to remove the brick and sill under the window, retaining the deconstructed historic material on site in the event the modifications are to be reversed. At its August 14th, 2024 meeting, the petitioner provided three design alternatives to the board for their determination of the one deemed most appropriate. They also provided numerous examples of rear additions that had been regarded as consistent in keeping with previous determinations of the board for additions of that nature. In reviewing the request, MPC Historic Preservation staff found that Scheme A in particular met the Secretary of the Interior and local district standards and was most visually compatible within the scope and meaning of the ordinance's design review criteria. The HDBR, in a split 4-3 vote, did approve this request for construction of a rear addition in accordance with Scheme A, as recommended by MPC Historic Preservation staff. The approval was contingent upon one condition, which related to specifications regarding a rear deck handrail. The appellant requests that the decision be reversed, asserting that the HDBR's determination was capricious, arbitrary, and erroneous. Just to share with you, these are the four proposed design schemes that were provided to the board at that August meeting date. This is Scheme A, Scheme B, and Scheme C. You can see there are slight variations, but ultimately the one that in its review, MPC staff and the HDBR both agreed that was most consistent with the design criteria was Scheme A. The petition was appealed and filed for, the original petition, again, that we're considering was filed on August 14th, and again, related specifically to 24-003810. MPC staff's report does accurately respond to each of the relevant elements enumerated by the ordinance section 7.8.7 for grant of a COA, considering the Secretary of the Interior standards, the requirements for visual compatibility, as well as the local district standards. Each of these things must be present in order to constitute a sufficient and adequate review based on the ordinance criteria, and it describes the reasons for staff's determination that the standards had been met. Following staff analysis, again, Scheme A was regarded as that most consistent. This is the existing residence at 201 West Jones Street, and you can see from Scheme A below that this is the chosen addition that was regarded as most closely aligning to the requirements of the ordinance. And so, the ordinance as well as the other criteria. And so you can see this from a different angle. This is what this would appear once this rear addition is constructed. Here we are again in the requirements for issuance of a COA. Visual compatibility shall not be the basis for appeal. And so in looking at this, the board has several options for how to dispose of this particular appeal, again, based on the same evidence that was reviewed by the initial reviewer. In looking at this, staff did find that the material submitted and approved in association with the petition. Staff finds that the initial evaluation was properly conducted in light of the criteria established by the ordinance for grant of a COA. That review was inclusive of the Secretary of the Interior standards, those for visual compatibility, and the relevant local district standards. Each criterion was discussed by staff in its report, and the specific scenario identified as most visually compatible was proffered as a recommendation, which the board opted to vote in favor of. And so accordingly, MPC staff does recommend that the HDBR's review be affirmed, as both staff's assessment and the board's determination were based on a competent and reasonable evaluation of the proposal against the established criteria. Additionally, we do ask that the board provide a statement for their particular agreement with staff's recommendation of affirmation. With that, I am happy to answer any questions. Sure.
How do I move up and down in the presentation?
So these are all the attachments.
I just want the PowerPoint and need to know how to move up and down. That's your screen. Okay. Mm-hmm. Very good. Good afternoon. My name is Andrew Jones. I'm with Thomerson Jones and Edwards. And my client is Anna Habersham Wright, who is here with us today. You haven't seen us in a while, and there's a good reason for that. And that's because over the last year, there actually has been a great deal of improvement in the decisions that the HDBR has been making. They've been adhering more closely to the ordinance. The MPC is making efforts to train the HDBR more closely with the ordinance. In fact, it's holding training on October 30th. Unfortunately, I think this case was an unusual one, an outlier, and unfortunately did not go well from the start with respect to adherence to the ordinance. We believe that it's arbitrary and capricious because the HDBR erroneously applied the three main standards and did not apply the demolition rules, the ones we just spoke about. This project is not a mere addition, but rather the demolition of a substantial portion of a contributing structure and the construction of almost an entirely new structure. Here's Chatham Square and vicinity. It's a pristine part of the historic district. It's rich in Greek Revival and Italianate architecture. And on the left, you see the building we're talking about, 201 West Jones Street. So it's visible from Jones Street. It's visible from Barnard Street. It's visible from Taylor Street. And it's visible from Chatham Square. And those three windows that you see at the top are the top windows of the higher portion of the building. And it's hard to see through the tree, but you can see a little bit of the porch of the lower building. And we'll go into more detail. On the right, the yellow house, 126 West Taylor Street, is where Ms. Wright lives. And she's lived there for decades. And before that, she lived, her parents' house was around the corner at 128 West Jones Street. So 201 is diagonally across from where she spent some of her childhood and teenage years. And the ordinance is supposed to protect contributing buildings. These are both contributing buildings. And it's supposed to protect 201 West Jones Street as a contributing building. But it's also supposed to protect Ms. Wright's building. She invested in this building with the understanding that the ordinance would be enforced. And what the proposal is that section of West Jones Street that you see here, you won't be able to see that. There's going to be a fake Greek Revival addition there. So this view from Chatham Square will be lost. The view that you see from the street will be lost. And I'll explain what that fake addition is. I'm going to skip over this slide for brevity. Here's the lower portion of the building. And it's likely that it is part of the original 1852 structure. The MPC staff commented in its earlier staff reports. And you can speculate as to how much is original, how much was added at different dates. But the bottom line is that it's all contributing. This brick section you see with the shutters, that thin wall is proposed to be saved, but what's behind it will be demolished. This porch that you see will be demolished. And this porch is highly visible. It's visible from the right of way. And the side, which is the rear of the lower section, is completely visible. And Edward does have a photograph that shows that all of that is visible from Jones Lane across the street. The historic building map determines the contributing resource status. It's set forth in 7.84, and when you look at the building supplement, which gives the details, the entirety of this building is contributing. And the map is created through a legislative process. It is not something that can be altered in a quasi-judicial proceeding. This project involves impermissible demolition. Now, you've heard the MPC and the HDBR describe this as an addition. It's not merely an addition. It's an impermissible partial demolition of a contributing resource and the construction of an almost entirely new structure. The applicant did not emphasize this. The MPC didn't address it, and the HDBR didn't address it. But the applicant did give the drawings, page 8 and 9 of their formal submittal package for review by the MPC and the HDBR, had two pages of demolition drawings. And I gave Edward hard copies because obviously this is a little hard to see. And what I did was I blew it up to get very specific. On the ground floor, it looks like there's one pier that's being demolished, and this wall that separates the interior from the exterior spaces is going to be completely demolished. All windows, doors, and brick walls removed. Then when you get to the parlor floor, and this is the part that's highly visible from all those different streets, and the brick walls, which he calls a brick veneer, brick walls are going to be removed. Some wood framing appears to have to be removed for those big windows they're going to put in. We don't know how much of the framing is being saved, but all existing windows and doors are demolished. So all the brick, all the windows, all the doors. And then when you get to this porch that's so visible from the street, these brick walls are being demolished. The porch and railings are being demolished, and the windows and doors. Then you get to the next floor, and there's an upper section of the building and a lower section of the building. In the upper section, One of the windows is being turned into a door. The other windows are being encased, and the whole thing is going to be obscured by the new construction. But what they didn't mention here, if you can see the architect's notes, demo existing roof and ceiling structure. So the roof, which is a characteristic of this building, this stepped approach, the roof is being demolished, and so apparently is the whole timber structure supporting the ceiling. So we're not talking about an addition plopped on the roof. This roof is going to be demolished. The walls then below the roof are going to be largely demolished, and all the windows and all the doors and all the other features. So this proposal involves demolition in areas constituting approximately a third of the building. The work on the ground floor, the parlor floor, and then demolishing the roof, and then those obscuring the wall. So if you take those demolition drawings and you try to figure out what is this rear facade going to look like, and yes, there's a fence, there's actually a door in the fence, and you could stick your head in that little entryway and see the ground floor, but you clearly see from the photographs I've shared with you the parlor floor and the upper floor. So the upper floor is going to be obscured, other than perhaps a little bit of the dental molding you might be able to see. And this dental molding goes the whole way around the building. It's a wonderful Greek Revival architectural feature. In the red square represents where they're going to break out the brick below that window. And then this, the lower section that sticks out, they're demolishing the roof, they're demolishing the ceiling. There some timbers, I guess, are going to be saved, but the windows are gone and the shutters are gone and the sills and the lintels and the staircase. I assume they're saving the floor timbers. So I put that in yellow as being obscured. You won't see them. And two posts are being saved, but they're going to be encased. And then the wall behind it is demolished. So this is the before and after of the rear. And the MPC erroneously ignored the rear portion and its lower floor. The MPC staff report stated, any work done to the home at the garden level and on the back half of the northern elevation will not be reviewed at this time, as the work will not be visible from the public right-of-way. So the bottom line in this case is the entire assumption behind the MPC's analysis, which is the HDBR's analysis, the entire assumption is wrong. It's erroneous. You saw it with your own eyes. You can see that from the public right-of-way. So the whole decision is erroneous. Its foundations are. And then the MPC staff refused to recognize the extent of the demolition. They said, this new application only includes the construction of a rear addition and the addition of stucco on the front stoop. That's all it includes. But we saw two demolition pages there. You know, I'm sure one could argue about the details of those demolition pages and the architect's annotations, but you know, he's saying he's demolishing all those things. This is not just an addition. So again, the staff report is missing a fundamental aspect of this proposal. Requirements for COA, Secretary of Interior Visual Compatibility Design Standards, and the Secretary of Interior standards can't be met by a demolition. I mean, just look at this language, the removal of historic materials or alteration of features and spaces that characterize a property shall be avoided. Construction techniques or example of craftsmanship that characterize a property shall be preserved. New additions, exterior alterations, or related new construction shall not destroy historic materials that characterize a property. And you remember you heard them say that they're going to keep these materials on site. All they mean are those little, the bricks in that section in the upper part. All the rest that's red here, that's going in a dumpster. On a separate angle on the interior guidelines, remember before I said a fake Greek Revival. Well, what the applicant showed is that this proposal borrows from other buildings, elements from other buildings that were never on 201 West Jones Street. 201 West Jones Street never had that third floor. The roof always did a step down to the garden. And here the applicant is saying that these are the buildings that he's using to copy. He's transforming this building at 201 into an attractive Greek Revival building that you find somewhere else. And he calls this design precedent. So he's given you undisputed facts of what he intends to do, how he got there, and what the plan is. But first of all, precedent is not a concept that appears in the ordinance, but the proposal is inconsistent with the Secretary of Interior standards, which say that changes that create a false sense of historical development, such as adding conjectural features or architectural elements from other buildings, shall not be undertaken. Shall not be undertaken. That's about as clear a prohibition as any law has. So at this point, you have the authority to apply the law to the uncontroverted facts. The applicant says that he's copying these Greek Revival elements from other buildings and to create this fake Greek Revival building. And the Secretary of Interior standards say that this shall not be undertaken. We know the HDBR has discretion. It's not clear that, well, actually, there's nothing in the record to suggest that either the MPC or the HDBR looked at these drawings and applied these drawings to that particular Secretary of Interior standards. So you can't defer to discretion that was actually never used. They never addressed it. So the options are obviously to remand and ask them to address it, or to simply deny the COA and they reapply. Arbitrary visual compatibility standards were not applied. So my client is not appealing an outcome on visual compatibility standards. Our assertion is that the visual compatibility standards as a matter of law had to be applied. And what they applied were not the visual compatibility standards, but a made-up standard that you compare to buildings you find anywhere. But that's not what it says. 7.89, the comparison is to visually related buildings which are defined as within view of the subject property. The applicant based it on buildings many blocks away. The majority of HDBR agreed with that, even said so, regardless of location. It's in the audio, and that's their audio site. So their decision was arbitrary and capricious because it was contrary to the standard. They did not apply visual compatibility. They applied something that doesn't exist in the ordinance, and their authority is only to apply what's in the ordinance. Interestingly, things are getting better. As of October 9th, they now do, and they made it very clear in the rejection of a six-story hotel at 301 Tatnall. They made it very clear that the applicant could not use properties that were many blocks away, and they said you can only look at properties that are nearby. So good news is you'll never, hopefully, ever see me again on this issue. So going forward, this issue is solved, but it was not applied in this particular instance. Now we get to the design features, the last of the three prongs, which affect the exterior walls, entrances, doors, windows, porches, balconies, porticos, and so on. All those things you saw being demolished in the demo. And so you start with alterations to contributing buildings. Exterior walls shall be repaired, windows shall be repaired, doors shall be repaired, porches shall be repaired, and the original roof configuration shall be maintained. Again, shall. But we all know that you can do an addition. That's in the law. When you get to the addition sections, the first thing it says is that additions shall comply with the above standards and the following standards. We'll get to those. So you've got to comply with all this, even if you're an addition. This proposal is not what the ordinance contemplates as an addition. I mean, remember this before and after. So we get to, and let me just jump back to the discretion point of view again, with respect to visual compatibility. Obviously, that's a very subjective, and you defer to them when they apply visual compatibility. But if they didn't apply it, if they used a made-up rule, that's not the kind of discretion that you want to defer to. So when we look at the, we're now under the design standards and the addition rules, there are a number, and here are a couple. Additions shall not obscure or damage any character-defining features. I mean, the dental cornice is a character-defining feature that runs around three sides of the house. It defines it as a Greek Revival building. Only a little bit's going to remain visible. The equally spaced windows, they're like the ones on Ms. Wright's house. Again, very characteristic of a typical Savannah Greek Revival look from the 1850s. This house is from 1852. Ms. Wright's house is from, I think, approximately the same time. The bottom line is that will be obscured. Additions shall be reversible with minimal damage to the contributing building. So there is a concept here that, you know, if you're going to put an addition on, something's going to get damaged, right? but it should be minimal. But if you look at this, you've got two-thirds of it, at least what you see, being demolished. That to me is arbitrary and capricious. You can't call two-thirds of a facade minimal. And then it says it shall be reversible, where there's nothing in the record that says all of that area that's being demolished is reversible. They don't even take that position. They just pretended that didn't happen. They filed the demo pages and then nobody talked about them. They would have to save all that brick. They'd have to save the ceiling rafters. They'd have to save the post things if the argument is that it's reversible. And there's nothing in the record that suggests they have any intention of any of that being reversible. So it's not reversible. It's not minimal. Then there is a lot of talk about the windows and that window being turned into a door. That's where they focused on reversibility, not the two-thirds of demolition. But they focused on that one little piece, and that was worth focusing on. But they just took promises from the owner that, you know, that will keep all this stuff on site. We don't know much about the owner and the record. We don't really know. There's no guarantee the owner isn't just going to flip this property once they get these approvals to make it a much bigger property. Just getting the approvals increases the value of the house. And when the new owner buys it, they're not bound by any promises the prior owner made. They're going to see a pile of bricks in the house, and they're either going to use them in the garden or toss them. So this, even the reversibility that they're talking about on this minor portion, it just isn't practical. So again, we think this needs to go back to the HDBR to apply the rules correctly. And hopefully after the training sessions on October 30th, they'll be in a better position. Also, this applicant does have other options. One is a text amendment. Whether a property is contributing or not contributing is a legislative decision. It's not a quasi-judicial decision. And so there's a process. You file a text amendment. You say, here's my building, but for various reasons, you make your arguments that I don't think this part's as good as the other part and should be taken off the building map. You can do that. That's a process. Whether you win or not, that's to be determined later. Other people do this. 301 Alice Street was a building that was landmarked. I mean, it was considered a contributing building, and the applicant applied to demolish it, and it went through the HDBR a couple of times, and then ultimately up to City Council, and they achieved demolition. Not a result I was happy about, but they followed the law. And to expect some people to follow the law, but not this person follow the law is, you know, the definition of arbitrary. There's another option. We were just looking at it, and where the numbers are a little different because we're in the downtown district, not in the other. But if the building is contributing, you can demolish it if you file an application under 3.19.9. And again, we're talking about partial demolition as well as whole. And then the HDBR has to determine that those criteria are met. We just have that. But in this case, and here's the application requirements, here's the demolition. But in this case, the applicant didn't do it. They can still do it. And it needs to be evaluated. The MBC and HDBR didn't even address the issue, whether it applied. And obviously, they had no application to review, and they didn't apply the criteria because there was no application. What this process is doing is it's pushing demolition through a quasi-judicial process by slipping in two pages that for some reason the MPC and the HDBR didn't focus on. Maybe they saw it, but they just didn't. There's nothing in the record that suggests they understood the extent of this demolition. And there are demolition rules, and to not apply these rules, it renders them irrelevant, and you can't interpret an ordinance such that sections are irrelevant. That's a Georgia law, and it's just the height of arbitrary and capriciousness to do so. And HDBR's discretion is not at issue because they didn't apply their discretion. Once again, you're seeing these major errors and oversights. And so they didn't apply their discretion. There's nothing in the record for this particular item that mentions 3.19.9. And we have an extensive record. I provided for the record the links for every single agenda, audio, minutes, And within the agendas are all the links to all these underlying documents. So we have a full record. It's just not in there. I'm going to skip some things. Well, I'll just, in the first, there was a first COA, and what we're talking about is an appeal of the second COA. In the first COA, they had originally wanted to even destroy that little wall there. And that was stopped under the first COA. And the logic used was that it was by the MPC was that it was tied into the building. They didn't cite ordinance sections or anything like that. They had a hunch, but they actually weren't applying standards. But they were kind of going in the right direction. But if that's tied into the building, then what about all these other walls that are tied into it? Well, too. I mean, even under their logic, the fact that they stopped at a certain point doesn't make any sense. Nonetheless, those aren't the standards. We've reviewed the standards. That entire visible parlor floor level of the rear section is protected and cannot be demolished either. So demolition was capriciously disregarded. And again, we need to remand to the HDBR. They need to look at these demolition diagrams and interpret them. Maybe their interpretation is different from mine, but they can't just ignore the demolition. And then when you stand back, what's happening here? Well, the entire character of this historic 1852 building is being obliterated. The views are being destroyed from the Jones Street side, from the Barnard Street side, Taylor Street, Chatham Square. The protection of contributing structures from demolition is fundamental to the historic district overlay. We're allowing people to get COAs, slip in a couple demo diagrams, the MPC ignores it and the HDBR ignores it, then what do we have? We're just going to lose things. This whole process needs to at least go back for a do-over. And with that, I would be happy to take questions.
Mr. Jones, were you in attendance at this Historic District Board Review meeting?
Yes, I've been in attendance at every single one of these meetings. Ms. Wright has been aware of this project from the very beginning. I attended your ZBA meeting. There have been a volume of letters, I think for this hearing, at least 18 in support of the appeal. And for many of the underlying items, there were letters sent from the public as well. I did reach out to Mr. Lurie to see if before this we could work something out. I have had luck with other people. That's another reason why you haven't seen me in a long time, because a lot of people will engage in discussion. But I did not have any luck. And unfortunately, Edward was of the opinion that he wasn't able to speak to me and that I could only speak to the city attorney. And I did communicate with Mr. Lovett a number of times, and we had some productive discussion, but he's a busy guy. Oops, sorry. And that's just kind of in limbo.
The reason for my question, did you raise any of these concerns during that meeting as a member of the public?
In my 2 minutes, as a member of the public, I certainly raised the visual compatibility issues. And certainly the design standards and the demolition of the windows, that I brought up, the lack of reversibility. But at a certain point, your 2 minutes runs out. I mean, you can have 20 great arguments and you just got to pick a couple, and you can't get all 20 out there. Now, in the future, what I'm trying to do is work with Jonathan in advance to express my concerns. So actually we have a meeting scheduled on a very controversial project so that we can find some type of resolution before it goes to a hearing. I had also similar luck when I represented Mikveh Israel with respect to the hotel being built between the two 18th century Jewish cemeteries, and worked with the attorney who was on the other side, and we reached a formal written agreement that runs with the land. So where we can, we're trying to resolve things. We are actually attending that same training with the HDBR, sponsored by the MPC, to make sure we're all on the same level. This somehow fell through the cracks, and I don't know what the reason is. It's got two big problems. Clearly, this is visible. I mean, there you see it. And to have an entire set of staff reports saying this is not visible is just erroneous. I don't know how there was that oversight, but it's an oversight. So here in this picture, what you see is this piece of wall is being retained, but the application is demolishing all these bricks that tie into it and this window and that window and then the two more windows and the railings and the porch and the entire roof structure going down the facade. So that was the big first problem. The second one is that the extent of the demolition just doesn't seem to appear anywhere in the record as an issue. And it's interesting because there was the focus on the demolition on that one window, but somehow all the other things managed to slip through.
Mr. Jones, I'd like to give the board a chance to ask any questions they might have. Do y'all have any questions for Mr. Jones? Go ahead, yes. Mr. Conner.
Good afternoon, sir. I appreciate you coming and presenting before the board today. As I understand it, the federal government's recommendations require you to differentiate between old and new, right? We don't want any fake history here, right? That's our big thing, right? And so as we discuss like the photo on the wall here, as I understand it, that's going to be enclosed. So that brick wall on the interior becomes an interior wall at that point.
Correct.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
From what I've seen of Plan A, which obviously your presentation up there, I would agree with you that it's quite obviously visually different, but aren't we supposed to do that? Aren't we supposed to make it different?
We have no objections to it being visually different. That is a way in which, in fact, it is consistent with the standards. So you are correct. What we're saying is that there's a special standard that says you're not supposed to create false history or borrow elements from other buildings. And this is the design is a very beautiful Greek revival, what we call, in New York City, we called them tea rooms, even when they were double stacked. It's beautiful. I know examples like that in Greenwich Village, down on Charles Street and 7th Avenue, but the Secretary of Interior doesn't want you to take one building and turn it into something right. that it never was.
I think you're correct on that. I think the problem that we have is that we create a little bit of a slippery slope in the sense that there's only a few different architectural styles here in the city. You know, it was all built mostly around the same time in the historic district. The Victorian district is the Victorian district because that's when it was built, right? So my concern is that if we take away this ability of the Historic Review Board to make these judgments, based on things like, well, it kind of looks like a building that's three blocks away as opposed to the buildings that are on Jones and so on that are right nearby. And I don't disagree with you that they should look like they were built around the same time, except the addition. The addition should look like it was built. I don't want any IMP designs here, right? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
If you almost are limited, aren't you, to what you can choose?
There's some limitations, but I think the Secretary of Interior standards is hoping for some originality. And the problem we have in this particular case, if the applicant had not submitted those pages 6 through 8, there'd be a lot more leeway because you could say it's Greek revival-ish, but no one has told me that it's a copy of a building on Abercorn or something.
Right.
Here he actually told you that and he showed you, image after image, and some of those are really close. So you've got a problem here where applicants
say, that building on Abercorn? I asked the question because, a lot of times guys will come before us and they don't understand it like you understand it. Okay. And they're living in their architect world where they're saying, oh, it's kind of like that building over there, and not realizing that's not helpful. We don't want it to look like something else. We want it to be interesting and unique and so on. That's my concern. The other piece of it is that demo is a reality, right? That while I agree, I don't want them. And you know what my position was on the house with the fire. I don't want willy-nilly these things to go on. The reality is, though, that folks do have the right to build additions on their homes. And what we have to do, and you help make sure that this happens, is that we do it so that it's in the best interests of the entire community. You can't come to Savannah and buy your big house and then convert the thing to something that should have been in Charleston. That's one of my big things, too. This ain't Charleston. So I think you've got some valid points, but I'm not sure that what you've presented is enables us to overturn the decision of the board, given that we've pushed it back to them once already.
I believe that, well, you are certainly correct in that you have an option to remand, and that would put the discretion back at the HDPR.
You don't have the option to remand it back to them. You have to make a decision, and then this decision will be appealed to the Superior Court.
Are there any other questions for the petitioner? I got a question for Mr. Lemon, if you please come forward before we enter into public comment.
Yes, Jonathan Mellon, Director of Historic Preservation, and
Mr.
I apologize.
Mellon, I'm sorry for keeping calling you Mr. Lemon.
Mellon. It's an easy name to remember.
I even wrote it here on my paper. the last picture that was up, could you put that back for a second?
Sure. And Mr. Jones? Yes.
Yeah. So this small portion here that has the roof coming off of it, is that an addition to the original structure?
It's a great question. So if you bear with me and let me, I'm sure you've learned by now, I'm not super technically savvy, but let me get to staff report 201 West Jones Street. And we do greatly appreciate the work that Mr. Jones does in Savannah to preserve historic fabric. Good minds can disagree. So just to provide a little context, this got a great deal of attention from the Historic District Board of Review. It first was before them in March. It was back before them in May, and it was back before them again in August. In addition, staff pays particular concern to any proposed removal of historic fabric and looking at the Secretary of the Interior standards. As you all know, in Savannah and in other cities, the rear elevations have historically been given more latitude in terms of what people could do. Anybody who walks down a lane in Savannah will notice some wonderful additions, some additions that maybe we don't love, but over time they have evolved organically on the rear elevations. Using the standard that I think is being argued today by the applicant here who's appealing, if you can't remove any historic fabric, you can't put an addition on your house. That has never been the standard. I'm fortunate to have worked in our nation's capital, worked very closely with the U.S. Commission of Fine Arts, that's where I was employed, and with the National Park Service. The Secretary of the Interior standards do not at all say you can't remove any historic fabric. That's not what the standards say. So I just want to provide a little context here. So when this first came to get to your chair's question, when this first came to our staff, we met with Mr. Laurie, who's the project architect. The original design, as noted, did call for the removal of this brick portion here. As well, it was going to be roughly the same roof, same height of the main roof. As Mr. Jones noted, and I can, if he doesn't mind me using some of his images. So we also were very concerned about this brick detailing, cornice work or corbel work that wraps around the building. And so after meeting with Mr. Laurie, he agreed and his clients agreed to lower the height. So just so you all are aware, all of this is being preserved. That's not being covered. We're not to say that some of it might be obscured from a certain angle, but it's all going to be remain there. In terms of the second floor, I mean, this is the basement, first, second. This rear wall is being preserved. What they're doing is lowering the windowsill here to provide the access. So just again, to provide a little bit of history on this, we did extensive research. Kelly couldn't be here today. She's had a doctor's appointment. It's one of her areas of expertise. She spent weeks researching this house, and I know the project architect did as well. We were not able to really find any evidence about this rear portion here when it really dated to. So it wasn't that we just kind of arbitrarily made a decision. We went out to the site more than half a dozen times to look at it. What convinced us about this sidewall here was that the brick is actually tied in to the brick of the main. And if that was not been there originally, either they hired a really, really good mason or it was original. However, the rear wall here and that porch, when we looked at it, it seemed pretty clear to us that that was not historic material. And I know the project architect will probably go into this some more, but he showed us interior photos that showed the framing that you could tell that some of those walls had been altered or were newer material. So again, I just don't want you to think that this was kind of an arbitrary decision, but we've heard some figures put out here about how much percentage of this building is going to be demolished. And I do not claim to be a math expert, but the front elevation, which is maybe 20, 25% of the house, is not being touched. The side elevation is being kept. The side elevation, obviously, because it's the longest, is probably 50% of the building is not being touched. The garage house is not being touched. On the rear elevation, what is being removed is that portion of the wall that we felt was probably the original historic fabric where the sill is being lowered, excuse me. So we did look very closely, at the Secretary of the Interior Standards. I don't think anyone who reviews projects, we don't think I should say anyone who reviews, does design review work, would consider what is being proposed here as a demolition. A demolition is when you're taking down the majority of the building. I've worked on many projects. We recently had one that went before the HDBR at 409 West Taylor Street, I believe it is. That was a demolition. That was a building that is going to be demolished. The applicant worked very closely with us. We did raise the demolition concerns early on. The design was altered a number of times. They came back with a scheme, with a design. I never like to use the word scheme, a design that the board felt, and I just went back and Caitlin, thank you. The board's decision said it was based on visual compatibility. So that was discussed at the board meeting. The majority of the board, it was a close vote, 4-3, I believe, said that they felt that this was visually compatible. And just to piggyback on, you know, my statement earlier related to the demolition at 1605 Abercorn Street, we have a board that has a very talented group of individuals. Obviously, occasionally comments are made that maybe shouldn't be made, but I spoke with some of the board members this morning who reached out to me. If you actually go back and listen, they did say, we support the staff report, and we feel that this is visually compatible, the folks who voted for it, obviously not the people who voted against it. So I just wanted to provide a little context here that this project has gotten a great deal of attention by us since March. We've seen numerous designs. We felt that it met the standards. We worked with the applicant. The applicant changed the design. And if the city wants to, you know, change the ordinance and say, you can't remove anything, we need to freeze Savannah in exactly as it is, that's the decision that can be made. But I don't think that's where what our existing ordinance says. And I personally don't believe that's what the people in the city of Savannah want. So I hope that provides some clarification.
Well, the reason I asked the question is if that's an addition, then and it's a contributing building, then it's the contribution is tied to a certain period of significance. And the fabric being removed is not necessarily part of that period of significance. And I wanted to know if that is correct or not.
So we were like, we did a ton of research on this house. We were not able to give an exact date of that rear portion. So as I said, it was our best determination that that side wall here, I'll go back to this section here, was more than likely original, or if not original, had been done within the period of significance. So that's why the applicant changed their design. Originally, this was all going to go. The applicant changed their design to retain this wall. What we felt was reasonable was the removal of this rear wall here, which had clearly been altered. The windows, the porch that's there, none of that is historic fabric. I would guess most of it is from like the 1980s, the porch and everything. So we're not talking about some, you know, cast iron porch on the rear of a house that obviously we're passionate about preserving the historic fabric of Savannah. I sound like a broken record, but we would never support a project if we thought that character defining, if you read our staff reports, were being removed, we would not be in support of it. So we did look at it very carefully. But again, sometimes, as I'm sure you all in your professions, you know, it's incredibly frustrating when you do historic research, you'll find 300 photos of one house and all this information about it. And then the house right next door, nothing. And nobody has it. And that's just the way it is. And so you have to rely on your training and your experience to make an educated recommendation. And then, you know, it's obviously up to our board, HDBR, to make their decision.
Thank you. That answers my question.
I'd like to make a motion that we limit all public comment to about 3 minutes, 2-3 minutes.
All right. Mr. Turner has made a motion to limit public comment to 3 minutes. Is there a second to the motion?
Second.
Seconded by Mr. Condon. Mr. Ball, how do you vote?
Yes.
Mr. Condon?
Yes.
Mr. Turner?
Yes.
Mr. Griffith?
Yes.
All right. Motion passes. We're going to enter into public comment. We'd not like to. You will be required to hold it to 3 minutes. You can use your whole 3 minutes or not all of it, but we will not be permitting to grant the remainder of your time to anyone else. It's yours and yours alone. First comment card here is Eli Laurie. And keep an eye on the timer there, because that's.
Good afternoon, Chairman.
Start his time over.
And sorry about that. Good afternoon. Eli Lurie. Firstly, I'd like to thank MPC staff. Their reports have been very thorough, and they have really done their due diligence with this project. Just a little background on this. On March 13th, we went to HDBR the first time with this project with a very different iteration of this, where we were moving more building material because we had assumed that this section had been a later addition. After that meeting, we did demolition in that space, and at that time, one of the MPC staff members came to the house and walked through the house with me, where you could see the construction methods that were used in this house. And from this point forward, moving south, everything was brick veneer on 2x6 studs. Everything was nominal. It was a 1970s addition. Everything above in the ceiling was also opened up, and that was all pressure-treated modern lumber. None of this building material in the back here was original to this structure, based on the building, the Sanborn maps, firstly, and secondly, the building methods that were used in this addition. So at that point, that whole section of the back facade and that roof structure were kind of put to bed as being issues and weren't brought up again until today. These were not brought up at the August 14th meeting. Nothing was mentioned of the like. So that's why we had focused at the last meeting about this one window and that sill there, because that was the, as everyone could agree on it, the historic fabric that was integral to the structure. And that is the only building material that we are touching on the structure that was being affected. And we are retaining that on site by means and methods that have been approved countless times in the city. And I'd also like to hit that the design precedent was being used to show what had been previously approved on the rear of structures similar to this. It was not being used as a copy and paste, and it wasn't being used as a falsification of history. We're not trying to replicate history. We're not weaving bricks into these bricks to make it look like one monolithic wall. We have very clear delineated lines between what's new and what was here originally, for everyone moving forward to know that this was later. We have setback restrictions on the new walls versus the historic walls, so that you have as much differentiation as possible. And so we feel like we have done our due diligence. This project has been heard many, many times, and it has been reviewed many, many times. So I can't imagine that something would go under the radar until now. because it's been, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lawrence. Mr. John A. Brown, are you here?
I support.
Come to the podium, please, and talk into the microphone because we're recording this.
I support.
State your name for record, Mr. Brown.
John A. Brown.
And state what it is you're supporting.
Andre's appeal.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you have anything else you'd like to say?
Just we need to, honor our architecture here without, littering a lot of things that were originals.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Brown. Mrs. Wood, are you still here? Artist Woods?
Okay.
Your turn.
Artist Wood, I think we have to be careful at looking at this Secretary of Interior's dogma suggestion that we definitely make it look different. I mean, there's some weird buildings that have been taken, from the 16th, 17th century and have modern outshoots. You've probably seen them online. One person I know that's on the UNESCO board has worked on his house recently, and he had a little fuss in Newport about an addition. And he wanted it all to look a certain way. And they said, but it has to be different. And he went ahead, he said, I'll put it different. It's going to be, he'll put the date of the addition, and that tells it all. So be careful. I also want to say that we often hear the admonition that we should speak ad hoc, not ad hominem. And therefore, I request that you disregard the ad hominem aspects of the letter sent to you by Mr. Charles. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Wood. Mrs. Isaacs?
Ellie Isaacs, Director of Preservation for Historic Savannah Foundation. We agree with staff's recommendation to uphold and affirm the decision made by the HDBR. To overturn the decision and disregard that project that fully meets the national preservation standards, design standards, and is visually compatible will undermine the authority of the HDBR. HSF has worked with the architect and the owners to ensure a compatible reversible addition that meets all of the standards for rehabilitation. The proposed addition is appropriate in height as it sits lower than the cornice line and is clearly subordinate and differentiated from the main house. It causes minimal loss of historic fabric and is viewed by Secretary of the Interior qualified professionals as being reversible. A multitude of rear additions exist within the historic district, and the rear facade is typically viewed as the most appropriate place to add an addition. Buildings are layered by different rates of change. They evolve. They tell stories, but only if they're allowed. Preservation is multifaceted. It is unrealistic to expect a living city to remain viable with no growth or evolution to our buildings. Outright denying the owner the right to build a compatible reversible addition is against what preservation aims to do by keeping historic buildings preserved and rehabbed for continued use. I did really good. Any questions for me? No?
Okay. No, just a public comment. Mr. Hunsrucker?
Hello, my name is James Hunsrucker. I'd like to support the appeal for many reasons. One is that I was present at the HDBR meetings, and the members of the board did not cite any contributing building within view of this building. So that was not the standard that was used to allow this addition, which is the standard that is now, as Mr. Jones pointed out, was used to actually reduce the height of the hotel on Tatnall Street from 6 stories to 3 to 4 stories is what they're trying to do now. So that is the standard that should have been applied in this case. I also like to point out that this building was cited in the National Park Service document created for Savannah at high expense to the National Park Service back in 2018, cited as an example of Savannah architecture that should be preserved, with the main building, open space, and the a secondary building in the back, and they are aware of what's going on in Savannah. And again, the examples that were used, are not contributing to, are not visibly contributing to this property. And with that, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hunter. I'm having a hard time reading this name, but Stephen DeCant.
Stephen Thekenat, you don't have to worry about the 3 minutes. I agree with whatever Mr. Andrew Jones said, and I support the appeal. Thank you.
Thank you. Ryan Gerrals.
Good afternoon. I'll try to be quick. I sent in a letter very late, so I'm just going to read it so it's on the record. My name is Ryan Gerrals. As an educated, trained, and working professional, both in the fields of preservation planning and historic preservation, which I think a lot of people don't realize are two different things, I honestly find this appeal to be a bit ridiculous. The petitioner went above and beyond their means to meet with actual preservationists, even as far away as Kansas, with a Sanborn map professional to review it, and to critique their plans to ensure that what they were proposing would be appropriate and cause minimal damage to the historic structure. The harsh reality that many staunch and diehard classicist individuals calling themselves preservationists fail to understand is that true preservation allows for alterations to historic structures. It allows for additions to be added to structures, and it allows for many things that these individuals may not believe in. The petitioner is not proposing to restore this building, and they have the right to follow that. Following actual tried and true preservation practices to make the decision not to restore and instead construct an addition allowing for the integrity of the historic building to remain extant. The petitioner, the MPC's historic preservation staff, and the Historic District Board of Review all followed the rules and regulations provided to them. They listened to the true preservation professionals in the room, and they made an educated and legal decision to approve the petition after several months of working together on creating a project which is deemed appropriate, met the standards, and allowed for the continuation of the integrity of the historic building. Appealing the decision made by the Historic District Board of Review would be a failure to recognize the knowledge and professionalism provided by the many real preservationists that contributed to the formation of the project, and I would find it a sad day for preservation if this were overturned. Historic preservation deserves to be taken seriously and not treated as a game to push overzealous groups of individuals' outdated agendas. Thank you.
Thank you. Mrs. Adler?
I yield my time.
Okay. Michael Thomerson?
Good afternoon. I am Michael Thomerson, and I fully support appeal number 16. I fully support Andrew Jones's historical preservation efforts. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Or is there anyone online that wishes to speak?
No, sir.
Okay. Mr. Jones, would you like to rebut public comment?
Certainly. I'm so sorry. I do hear Karen people. Green, the chairperson of HDBR.
Does she want to speak? All right. Are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, great. Sorry I couldn't be with you. I'm a little under the weather, so be thankful I'm not spreading my germs. I did want to just restate in defense of the board that I represent in our decision. We made a decision based on a staff report and the application that was before us, and we found that both the preservation and the design standards were met. In addition, the majority of the board found the project to be visually compatible. As previously mentioned, this is not the first time that this project has been before us, and it has been debated at length. I think that things that were brought up today, while interesting for other boards to review or other applications, that is not what we were reviewing and not part of the review process. So I would ask that you uphold our decision and the integrity of the process and the rules that govern both of our boards.
Thank you very much, ma'am.
Thank you.
I might have skipped Michael Edwards. Are you here? I'm sorry, sir. You must have got lost in the shuffle.
Good afternoon. I'm Michael Edwards. I'd stand on behalf of the appeal. I support the appeal. I would like to say, as was mentioned by one of the staff members earlier, I think it's very important for us all in the room to recognize that there are reasonable, intelligent, and thoughtful minds and views on these issues can differ, but they certainly warrant equivalent consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. All right, Mr. Jones.
Thank you. I will try to address those comments ideally in order. And the first one is this view that all of this stuff was reviewed and they spent all this time looking at it and they made all these considerations and all that. It's very convenient to say that now. But why don't we go to the MPC's actual words? Their actual words, MPC staff report, any work done to the home at the garden level and on the back of the northern elevation will not be reviewed at this time as the work will not be visible from the public right of way. This is what the record says. Now, I know people are saying different things today, but you can only make decisions based upon what's in the record. This is the quote, and it is in all the documents that are linked. So they're saying they never analyzed it for purposes of the HDBR. Did they analyze it in internal conversations? Maybe. But the HDBR was told in the staff report that none of this matters because it was not visible from the public right of way. So therefore, this entire proceeding has unfortunately been erroneous. If you turn this down because it was entirely erroneous, the applicant simply files a new application and everything gets corrected. So if you can't remand, you turn it down, but they're not going away. And then the MPC's HDBR will get their training. Maybe they can address some of these issues more closely. But the record that we're dealing with is the May 8th application, and what was being sent up to the HDBR does not address all those things that were just said to have been addressed. So it was not part of the formal review process. Now, a number of the opponents to the appeal argue in the extreme. Mr. Jones is saying that you can't possibly ever have any additions, and of course everyone has a right to an addition, and I hope you see through that. That's a very typical argument technique. I think you saw very clearly how I addressed this issue, and that was with respect to looking at these actual rules. And of course, you
can
have an addition.
You're only supposed to be addressing the comments that were made by the public, so you're kind of straying a little.
No. That was that idea that that was actually definitely more than one speaker said that I would not permit any kind of addition, and I believe Illy Lurie said that as well as some of the first speaker.
Right, honestly, I think Mr. Mellon touched on
it. Yeah, Mr. Mellon said that. And so I have to respond to it. And what I'm saying is, of course, you can have an addition. The ordinance allows it. It says reversible with minimal damage to the contributing building. Now, minimal damage is subjective, but there's a lot of demolition here. This is not minimal. Now, what they're trying to do is say that, oh, well, it's not historic, and therefore you shouldn't consider it, and so on. But it's minimal damage to the contributing building, not minimal damage to the best pieces that they like. It's to the contributing building. And until there's a text amendment, the contributing building includes that porch and that whole exterior. They can damage some of that. They can remove some of it, some minimal part. But this certainly, to me, doesn't meet any kind of rational person's definition of minimal. Additions shall be reversible with minimal damage to the contributing building. If they want this contributing building to not include that slice on the back, and again, they have not proven what date that dates to, but that's an argument to make when you go for a text amendment. They could say, you know, everything except for that wall was a mistake. It was a mistake to include it in the contributing map. We're going to redraw the line. They can do that. They have that legal process. And that is a legislative process. That's what city council is supposed to determine. Instead, what this is an attempt to go around the city council process, around the legislative process, and to have those considerations brought into somehow redefining which portions of this building are the contributing building. But the map is the determinant of the contributing building. So they have solutions. They can get what they want done, but they want to do it through a process, which means that you, or they're trying to make you and the HDBR undermine the authority of city council. They talked about, you know, the percentages, of the building. Again, the whole building is contributing. And you're going to get into a real issue if there's an argument, okay, so 30% of destroying 30% of the building is fine, or destroying, let's say they say it's only 15%. We'll do 15, 20, 30, 40, 50. No, there's a rule. You're not supposed to be demolishing contributing buildings unless you go through a process. Otherwise, we can push this number up over time to 80 or 90, or maybe all we leave is just the outer shell of the building. They were talking about 1605 Abercorn, or actually they were talking about demolition, saying this is not a demolition. I specifically said this is a partial demolition. That is a concept. We have that in 1605 Abercorn. This clearly is partial demolition of a contributing building. Maybe it's not the best pieces of the building, but that's not the decision to make. The decision is it a demolition of a contributing building on the map? They have ways of getting around it, but they're not doing it. We heard over and over visual compatibility was applied. No, a false made-up version of visual compatibility was applied, not the standards that were written into the ordinance. The HDBR, fortunately, has corrected themselves as of the decision on 301 Tatman. So good news. I said I won't be here on that issue ever again. But this slipped by with the wrong approach. The minority, Sabrina Nagel in particular, told all the other board members that you can only look at the buildings that are nearby. She said that is what the ordinance requires. And it was the tiebreaker who emphasized basically he didn't care. He didn't care. He was going to look to other buildings. The sidewall. So we're supposed to believe that the sidewall is original, but never had a roof. Those roof timbers are later. Somebody just built a sidewall, just standing free floating. I think there's just something wrong with the way that they're approaching this. Eli Lurie talks about this all being brick veneer, but that's strange because actually you should remember even in the appeal that he had, he was talking about these bricks and how they were taken from other houses. And in fact, he said so in the ZBA hearing, his application pages 17 through 18. So a lot of these are bricks. Now let's look at this picture, for example, parlor floor demo. The thin area is what he calls brick veneer. It's not very clear because he said before it was bricks. Now he's saying it's a veneer. But look at this porch wall. That's a thick brick wall. I don't think that that's veneer. Whether or not it is, again, doesn't affect whether it's a contributing building. The window, again, you've heard about reversibility. Unfortunately, this type of reversibility is a myth unless you've got a contract with covenants that run the property so that if this guy sells it to somebody and they sell it to somebody else, the materials stay on site. Otherwise, it's fictitious. We're not arguing against differentiation, to make that clear. But where the applicant says it's a copy and the design the Secretary of Interior standards say you can't just do a copy, you're just in a very different decision-making decision. National Park Service, someone brought that up. I'll just mention that since that did come up. I skipped over the slide. So in 2018, the National Park Service downgraded Savannah to threatened status. And they had a section talking about what the threats to the plan were. And one of the first, it said, was overdevelopment in the rear of buildings. It's valuable real estate. People want to expand. And they had an example of what should be saved in terms of the house cascading into the garden and the carriage house as being sort of the quintessential classic Savannah home. And they had this picture. They actually labeled it as Jones and Bull, but I think we can all conclude today that this is actually Jones and Barnard, the building we've been talking about. So, you know, this is a quintessential classic Savannah building. You see it from Pulaski, Chatham Square, the adjoining streets. NPS thinks this is a really great example. And this is an example of what's good and what's being threatened today. There's just a terrible, terrible irony into thinking that that's going to be demolished now. I do find it sad that one of the speakers has to imply that we are uneducated and not trained and not informed. HSF talked about true, or I believe it was HSF, that true preservation allows for addition. I agree. And I showed you the standards, minimal change. They say that that there's no requirement to restore. Actually, I show you the design standards are pretty clear. You've got to restore other than some minimal areas that you can change in order to get your addition. And a lot of additions are separate buildings that are attached. Recently, 123 West Oglethorpe, big addition, but it had a hyphen. And as I mentioned before, the HDBR did not follow all the standards. They clearly did not follow the visual compatibility standard that's in the ordinance. They did not address the issue of the false sense of history, even when being presented with it. And I think that I've addressed all the pertinent points. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. At this time, we're going to enter into board discussion. Mr. Griffith, do you have anything you'd like to add?
No.
How about you, Mr. Turner?
No, sir.
I'm sorry. I know you're in board discussion, but I just wanted to note what's being appealed here is the decision from August. And if you look at the staff report from August, there was a statement made that we didn't discuss the exterior walls. There's a section on page 6, exterior walls, that talks about the applicant proposing the removal of rear wall materials. Staff finds the work to be appropriate given that it's on the rear of the building. That select portions of the rear of the home, chiefly on the parallel level, have been altered over time. So the notion that we didn't talk about it in the staff report is not correct. It's right there. You all can see it on page 6.
I have to write
on page 6.
All right. Thank you. Thanks. Go ahead, Mr. Jones. And then after this, we will be entering into board discussion. There will be no more comments whatsoever.
Sorry for the addition. So if he's saying to the HDBR that, you know, this later part of the building doesn't matter because it was built later, which is, I think, the essence of the argument that I just heard, that's simply not correct as under these rules.
I think Mr. Mellon was just trying to clarify that it was discussed and he read from the minutes of his report.
It was discussed, but not in light of the demolition or the nature of a contributing status as being the determining factor. He was misleading the HDBR into thinking they could just trash and dislike parts of the building and treat it differently. But thank you.
Duly noted. Mr. Condon, do you have any comments?
I appreciate Mr. Jones and the neighbors coming and expressing their opinion. I also appreciate the fact that as has been stated, smart, educated, and knowledgeable folks can disagree. And I think that as I look through this and you know, I've reviewed this during the week when we got our packets, and you know, as this is the second time now that it's come before us. I think that we have to consider the fact that it's really a slippery slope if we don't allow our historic review boards to make these informed decisions. It's what they're expert in. You know what I mean? And I don't see anything presented here today that makes me feel as though they haven't made an educated and informed decision. I don't see, you know, we can discuss what's demo, what's renovation, you know, we can get into the fine, you know, definitions of words and so on. You know, I've been a builder a long time. I've seen architects just put things on things that are mistakes. That's not what they meant, you know? And so from my perspective, I think that, while I appreciate Mr. Jones' hard work, I don't think that he's proven that the board acted erroneously.
Thank you, Mr. Conant. Mr. Ball.
No.
No. All right, the chair will entertain a motion. Does someone care to make one?
I make a motion that we affirm the Historic District Board of Review's recommendation.
By denying the appeal.
By denying the appeal.
Mr. Condon has made a motion to uphold the Historic District Board of Review's decision by denying the appeal of Mr. Jones. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Ball. Any discussion on the motion? Mr. Ball, how do you vote?
Yes.
Mr. Condon?
Yes.
Mr. Turner?
Yes.
And Mr. Griffith?
Yes.
All right, the motion passes and appeal is denied. Next order of business, we are going to have the nomination of officers for 2025, and I'd like to kick that off by nominating Stephen Plunk to be chairman.
Second.
Second by Mr. Griffith. Any other nominations? We've got to also nominate a vice chairman. I'm fine with nominating you if you still want to do that.
I like my role as vice chairman.
Okay. Well,
second.
I'd like to nominate Mr. Condon as vice chairman.
Second.
Seconded by Mr. Griffith. Y'all are free to nominate anybody you want. Okay. Well, then let it be entered into the record that Mr. Plunk is the only person being nominated to be chair, and Mr. Condon is the only one nominated to be vice chair, and we will have elections next meeting after there's been due notice and all that stuff. If there's no other business, we'll be adjourned.